Blog Talk Radio.
Now, PW Torch and Spreaker bring you the Wade Keller Pro Wrestling Post Show. It's time to talk this week's AEW Dynamite on TNT.
So how about that Britt Baker win, Eric? No, I'm kidding. Good. I'm glad I got a laugh out of that one. I wasn't sure. So yeah, Blood and Guts completed. We have the Elite celebrating in the ring. Eric, I just got to jump right to the lead story, of course, Kota Ibushi. You've been excited ever since this was even a twinkle in Kenny Omega's eye as a possibility. Did it live up to what you were hoping?
It did not. Yeah. As far as the match did, but Kota's participation in it did not. He didn't look like the sculpted out of granite guy that I couldn't believe was an actual human being back in 2018 when I first saw him.
Yeah.
And some of his strikes looked soft.
Yeah.
Like noticeably. I'm like, what's going on here? You know, he got a nice spot or two. The music was weird too. It maybe it's one of his past scenes from some early promotion he was in, but it felt to me very generic. You would think they could have gotten his music from New Japan, the Golden Star scene, but maybe not, given how Ibushi left that promotion on bad terms. So for me, you know, is there still room for him to be a special attraction, right? He had some decent spots where he kicked the heck out of all of the heels to save his face teammates when they were all in submission moves. But I'm a little bit worried at this point. Yeah. I'll be honest.
I was thinking of you. I mean, I was like, we're like deep into the match, and I'm like, has Kota had a moment? You know, has he had is there anything standing out? And I mean, sometimes, you know, when I'm typing up the report and trying to keep up, I'm like, well, maybe I missed something, but I didn't think I did. And I was like, you know, they made a really big deal out of this, and Excalibur's like, they were known as the Golden Lovers in Japan, which had to be like a double take or a spit take for some people who just like AEW but are New Japan fans or don't really know. They're like, they were called what and why? But, you know, I mean, they treated it like a big deal, and he got a key spot in terms of the entrance order. But, yeah, then it happened. He kind of blended in, you know. I mean, he got, you know, breaking up a bunch of submissions. You know, it was kind of like his moment, but – For as excited as you were, I was watching this going, I'm thinking Eric's going to be a little let down by what he saw. But the match itself, stepping back for a moment, how'd you feel about the execution of it? Kind of talk about what you think were some of the highlights or memorable moments, and also I want to know what you thought of the finish.
So, I mean, it was good. They clearly, they've built each one of these. This was the third one. AEW has built around a big spot. The Jericho version of it, I think, was built with a crash pad spot that I know you panned at the time in 2021, Pinnacle over Inner Circle. And last year, it was built on fighting on top of the cage. Blackpool Combat Club has faces against the heel Jericho Appreciation Society with the submission coming on top of the cage, I think. And then this year, obviously, it was a deathmatch light type of theme to the match, which, not surprising given it's John Moxley and that's his thing. There was the spots where they went through the tables. There was the broken glass. I couldn't believe they went to the broken glass that early. I've never seen a thumbtack rain shower before. So, you know, these are innovative people who want to do something fresh and new, and they did. I think everyone knew from the start, from the time the match was announced, that Wheeler Yuta was going to be submitting in the end. And in this case, he passed out, and John Moxley threw in the towel for him, figuratively speaking, according to the announcers. I didn't pick that up in real time, I'll admit. And I guess to me, the ending hit weird psychology because the heels went down 5-3, which is generally not how wrestling psychology works. If anything, the faces should have gone down a man, right, to make the comeback all the sweeter. But it I strongly suspect that Pac walked out because he's going to be the challenger for Claudio on Friday night's ROH pay-per-view.
That because you know, think about Tony Khan's media call, and he's like, "Yeah, we gotta go to Plan C because we can't fly Eddie Kingston in, and Mark Briscoe's out." And so, yeah, this I'm curious what they would have done for if that spot would have been completely absent if it weren't for that situation. My hunch is it would have been.
Yeah, it was. I'll just say I thought it was a weird choice, both from a psychology standpoint and for this ROH pay-per-view has had such little buildup and has barely been mentioned at all on AEW TV. Not that I'm complaining, mind you, because it's what ROH is, AEW Dark, Black and Red, I think I've heard it called. I wouldn't have done that. And then Takeshita leaves and it's 5-on-3 for the faces, which made it even weirder. I guess in a way it sort of saves face for the heels for the Blackpool Combat Club.
Yep.
But, you know, I don't know. I mean, this match is supposed to be a feud enders. And I think next, obviously, it's going to be Kenny versus the Callis family, possibly including Chris Jericho. I'm interested to see how Blackpool Combat Club reacts to Takeshita and Pac leaving. Is this going to be a new direction for them? Or is it just going to be purely to set up an ROH pay-per-view main event? Which, again, weird.
Yeah, I was 2 minutes behind on my DVR. Just full disclosure. And then I look at the clock, I'm like, oh my God, they're not going to end on time. And it's 2 minutes past nine central. And I just missed 2 minutes. And I came in right as the finish was happening. So I missed the Takeshita walkout, but I'm catching up on that. And I have to be better about recording the cube after Dynamite, because I know they're not always good. And unfortunately the DVR doesn't adjust right away. I can't set it like the old days on cable where I can say just record anything sports for, you know, an extra 30 minutes to carry over. So, yeah, I think you're right, though, that they wanted the heel faction, so to speak, to save face and not be united. So, you know, Takeshita's in his own, you know, in his own with Callis, and then you're setting up the Pac-Claudio match. The psychology is there, but I think it takes away some of the – I guess because like even the celebration, and I'm you know scrambling to get set up to do the podcast right afterwards, but it didn't feel like this was like it just felt like people kind of walking around the ring like they were waiting for a taxi, you know, like as music was playing. It wasn't like this this moment of elation. We have conquered this obstacle, and like you said, it didn't feel like it settled the feud. So the match lived up to the billing. I mean, we had fighting, you know, Northern Lights suplexes galore and fighting on top of a cage and thumbtacks and glass. And we didn't get fire, did we? I didn't miss fire, did we?
I don't believe so.
Yeah, the fans were chanting for it once they called for a table and got it. I was wondering what the third thing was if they got fire. Like, what are they going to ask for next? So, I mean, yes, it was a enjoyable 50-minute match with a lot of talent doing a lot of cool stuff. But yeah, in the end, it felt like, well, we're doing the match because we do it. We had some injuries. We're telling some other stories. And so, yeah, it just didn't quite feel like this triumphant moment that a match with this type of stipulation and gimmick and just pure duration probably should. I'm not like really down on it. I'm just like, it was enjoyable, but it doesn't have this like punctuation mark at the end. I do think the finish is kind of clever, but it sort of makes Moxley a sympathetic character standing up for his friend who is outnumbered and getting beaten up. So yeah, just the emotions just weren't quite there for me. If I just kind of put myself in that where AEW wants viewers to be, which is, you know, rooting for the elite against BCC.
Yeah. I think in a lot of ways, this match, I had sky high expectations because you're going to have some of the best, most innovative people in wrestling who actually care about the matches, right? Their craft.
Yeah.
You know, the elite especially care about the in-ring stuff, certainly more than, you know, you could argue than the outside of the ring stuff, like promos and whatnot. So in a lot of ways, I thought this would blow me away and I wouldn't be able to speak tonight on the post show because I would just be at a loss for words. And you throw on the debut of Kota Ibushi, and I probably expected too much. There was this movie about 20, 20, 20 years ago called The Royal Tenenbaums, that I think it's a Wes Anderson film. And I thought from the trailer, I thought, oh my God, look at this cast. Gene Hackman, Angelica Houston, Ben Stiller, all, you know, the Wilson brothers. This is going to be incredible. This is going to be the greatest movie I've ever seen. And then it was just good. Right. And
right.
So,
yeah.
It wasn't a bad movie. It just wasn't, you know, the break the Roger Ebert 4-star scale classic that I was hoping for, which is not to diminish what they did and how they put their bodies on the line. But just that's, you know, part of the problem when you have high expectations. It's hard to meet them sometimes.
Yeah. Yeah. And you know what? I mean, it's fine. I mean, you know, we can critique, you know, was there a better direction to go? But they had different things that they were trying to accomplish and different obstacles with Bryan Danielson out injured. And, you know, I mean, I don't know. Yeah. I mean, I'm not down on it, but I'm not raving about it either because, again, that emotional crescendo wasn't quite there. And I think the finish goes a little bit against the, you know, the spirit of baby faces beating heels, you know, 5-on-3. So anyway. Let's pop. We got calls on hold, emails coming in. We got Mike McMahon joining us as our on-site correspondent later. He's watching Rampage right now, but PW Torch's own Mike McMahon, an AEW podcaster for years. Excited to have him on to get his take on it. He'll be joining us in a bit. Got a lot scheduled, but let's pause and just formally introduce ourselves and give out the phone number and email. This is the Wade Keller Pro Wrestling Post Show for Wednesday, July 19th, 2023. And this is our coverage of AEW Dynamite for Wednesday, July 19th, 2023. Did I just say the date twice? I'm just totally lost.
Well,
I like to emphasize things. Make sure people know. I'm Wade Keller, host of the show, the editor, publisher, and founder of Pro Wrestling Torch, the newsletter, the website, and a bunch of podcasts, which you can find out more about at pwtorch.com/govip. If you want to hear ad-free, commercial-free versions of our free shows, along with some VIP exclusives like the Wade Keller Hotline, post-PLE roundtables, and so much more. And, and check out our website, pwtorch.com, Keller's Take editorials that you won't find anywhere else, including the insight into the differentiation between Collision and Dynamite that others are picking up on today that we had days ago. And I put that in context in the Keller's Take editorial, talking about how so far so good for Collision in terms of differentiating itself from Dynamite. Some new details coming out from Fightful that there was actually a locker room meeting where some things were really spelled out about the pride that they're taking in that differentiation. Check out pwtorch.com for live TV coverage, editorials, breaking news, including exclusive behind-the-scenes insider news throughout the week in different reports. Make it one of your go-to stops each day. The other voice you hear on the show so far is Eric Kroll. He is a former Pro Wrestling Torch columnist over 30 years ago when we were just like college age types, writing about wrestling in a very different era. And he, as listeners know, he took some time off, raised his family, and then New Japan and AEW got him back into wrestling. He's been contributing to Torch podcasts and writing some guest editorials and features for the Torch since then. And it's always great having him on the show. He's a good friend of mine. Eric, welcome.
Thank you for the giving me the shine on that intro, Wade. Very, very generous of you.
Well, now we'll see if it pays off.
Speaking of setting high expectations, you can't possibly live up to.
That's right, yes. All right, so everybody who's live streaming the show, you are welcome to give us a call. The number, if you want to join the show, is 347-215-8558, 347-215-8558. When you call, push 1. That flags you on the switchboard and lets us know you want to be on the show. You can also email us at wadekellerpodcast@pwtorch.com. That's Wade Keller Podcast at pwtorch.com. If you want to live stream the show, just go to pwtorch.com during Raw, Dynamite, SmackDown, or Collision and look for my TV report. At the top and bottom of the report is the phone number, the email, and a link to live stream the show. You can live stream it over the internet or you can call and just listen in on your phone, whatever works better for you. You can do what most people do also and just download the show later. We put it up later in the evening on our podcast feed, search Wade Keller, and subscribe to this, the Red Logo Show, and also our Blue Logo Show, the regular podcast. And while you're at it, search PW Torch to subscribe to the free PW Torch Daily Cast lineup, a different show with a different theme every day of the week. And try the PW Torch VIP free sample feed while you're at it. A Wade Keller hotline from earlier this week dropped on that feed. It's a charcoal colored logo. And if you're using the iPhone native app, you can upgrade to the full VIP podcast lineup using your Apple account just with a couple clicks on your iPhone. So a pretty friction-free way to hear these shows with the ads and commercials taken out and also get all the VIP shows on one feed. But full details on other VIP sign-up options at pwtorch.com /govip. All right, so let's just get to it. Let's start taking calls and fit them in. We've got Javier Machado, PW Torch contributor, who's been covering New Japan G1 for us, speaking of VIP podcast with New Japan Pride podcast, and he'll be joining us in a few minutes, too, to give his take on things. So it is an all-star Torch cast tonight. But first things first, we've got Nick from Brattleboro, an all-star caller. Nick, welcome. You are first up. LaMarcus from D.C. is on deck, by the way. Nick, thanks. Good to talk to you.
To talk to you, Eric. Good evening. I have to wait and let all this settle. So, but one thing I wanted to mention is, did you guys get the impression that television angles were driving me crazy? It's almost like people at the show probably got a better take on what was going on in the ring than the television audience. It was like they kept switching back and forth, and they missed moves, and they pretty much missed the Pox thing from the ceiling. And it was a little disconcerting.
Eric, you were not typing feverishly and double screening like I was. How was the experience for you? Just kind of with your eyes glued on the screen, and did that jump out like it did to Nick?
Yeah, I think there's something to that. I think Nick is right. Is this Mike Mansouri's first time producing this kind of thing? I don't know what he did in if he was involved with the NXT versions of this when they were doing it. I noticed that wrestlers seem to like disappear for 10 minutes at a time.
Yes.
In my notes, I'm like, where's Hangman? Is he even in the ring? Like,
I made a mental note of that to bring that up. Like, when Hangman suddenly setting up the buckshot, which by the way was one of the low points of the night, because Claudio just sat there and stood in position and put his neck in place and stared at Hangman as Hangman came at him, and he just let him give him the buckshot. It just was poorly set up. There was another leap into the ring, I think it was by Nick Jackson maybe, when he entered, and he just completely missed whoever, Moxie or whoever he was punching at. Didn't look good. There's some low points too. But yeah, Hangman just felt kind of invisible, Eric. Between Kota and Hangman, I tell you, I'm glad that you managed to show up.
Yeah, it's not a red letter night for my fandom. I think there was a moment, maybe, Nick, where Omega and Ibushi were about to do a Golden Lovers style double team move. I'm not sure what it was. I think Excalibur might have called it the double kick Young Bucks do, and they almost missed. I think they almost missed it, and then didn't end up doing it anyway. I think it was a swerve. I think somebody, the heel, broke it up. But it's. I think it's that kind of stuff you're talking about, right?
Yeah, yeah. No, and it was just like, in other words, they'd be focused on one thing, and they would switch the camera so fast away from what you were watching, and go to the far shot that you couldn't see anything because of the grating. You know, and then they'd zoom back in, and it was very disconcerting. It was just, it took me out of it at times. I mean, the match was what it is. It's a, you know, it's a gory bloodfest, and I think they can do away with the bed of nails thing because, first of all, they zoomed in on it, and you can see that the nails were flattened, and Moxley got dumped on it, and it's bleeding, and then, like, it was about 5 minutes, 10 minutes later, and they had a shot of his back, and there's no hole, there's no blood.
Yeah, there's one cut. Yeah. The glass, too. Like,
yeah.
I mean, I don't want to tell it. I mean, I don't need to watch magic and go, oh, that's so fake. They did, you know, like,
yeah, right,
I mean,
yeah.
They're obviously not going to do it. But at the same time, when you land on glass, like if I accidentally step on glass, I'm like bleeding for like, you know, 6 hours, you know, like if you step on glass accidentally in bare feet or something like that. And here they are landing on glass and there's no cuts. It's sticking to them because it's sticky. It's not because it's sharp and cutting into their skin. So yeah, some of the, I mean, I'm okay with it, but I mean, we do have to say it's not particularly realistic, but you know, I mean, you got to suspend You got to be willing to suspend a little. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, you go to a David Copperfield show and you know the elephant's on the stage, but you don't see it. And then you see it and it's like, oh, okay, that's very cool that you fooled me. But I just think the bed of nails thing is like almost a step too far for me. I mean, it's.
Sure. I get that. Yeah.
you know. I want to go away from the blood and guts match for a minute and just say that I don't know what they're doing with Cole and MJF, but I'm really not liking it. I know at the end they tried to bring MJF back into the evil side, but that match was a joke. The whole match was just a joke, and I don't know why they're doing that to MJF. I don't. Obviously, MJF and Cole are going to meet at either at Wembley or at All Out. But I thought that match was terrible. From a story standpoint.
Yeah, Eric, we have not. It is a major topic that we got to get into. It is absolutely going to be polarizing. We had a dance-off. We had Sammy and Garcia doing things that we can never unsee. We had Adam Cole and MJF doing things we can never unsee. And, I mean, the small sampling that I've seen, there's people enjoying it and endorsing it, and other people who think it is the most, well, I don't want to overstate things, but it is not something that they hope someone walks into the room and sees while they're watching AEW. And the whole point of AEW, and I'm exaggerating when I say this, but still, the whole point of AEW was to be a wrestling show where anybody could walk in the room while you're watching it and they think, hey, this looks cool. What's this? And that was something different over there. So, Eric, go ahead.
To Nick's question, I don't think they're doing this to MJF. I think MJF is driving the bus on this one. I think he is front and center in all of this creative, as he is with usually is with his creative. So I don't like the build to the inevitable all in London title match between MJF and Cole, right? I have not liked almost any of it. I can't deny that it's certainly over. It was over in the buildings night in Boston. It's popped ratings. You know, to me, the dance-off before the match is a blatant aim to try and create a viral moment, right, that gets tweeted and debated and posted. It's just so far from what I like about wrestling in AEW. It's creating problem. It's creating a obstacle or a problem for them because it's been all let me clean up my language. Fits and giggles during this, you know, comedy tag team up, right? And at some point they're going to have to pivot to a serious turn and some sort of beatdown to set the stage for the world title match, right? That is inevitably coming, probably headlining All In after, you know, they got five more Dynamites to do it. The comedy stuff makes it a challenge because it's going to be a really abrupt shift in tone. Maybe that's how these angles always end up historically in wrestling, when they do the comedy and then they got to turn the heat on to build for an actual match. You can have MJF beat up Adam Cole after they lose to FTR. I don't think they've announced when that match is, but sometime in the next few weeks. You know, they started that pivot with the post-match belt tease where, you know, MJF's like, you're holding my precious, right? Which is a time-honored way of illustrating dissent in wrestling. So five more Dynamites. What are their options here to lead to the breakup? As mentioned, MJF beatdown of Cole, or one of them turns on the other at the end of the match to cause the loss, right? Because you don't think they're going to put the tag team titles on them. That would be very dumb. And, if it's Cole who causes MJF to lose, maybe that enrages MJF and gets him to give Cole a title shot, right? The whole Cole was manipulating him all along, that would prevent Cole from looking like a dumb baby face. But if it's MJF turning on Cole and Cole gets got, you know, because MJF is a snake who can never be trusted, Cole looks like the dumb baby face, right? I mean, so I guess
that's the concern of mine throughout all this. And there's things that amuse me about this. But what is the end game, or is this just we're starting to see maybe a side of both Cole and MJF? I don't think either of them are drag kicking and screaming into this, but I haven't heard otherwise. And I do think, you know, we've seen MJF do a wide array of stuff. He likes to show his range. But I am concerned about what the end point is, but I keep saying I'm going to see it through. I'm along for the ride, and I don't want to be too harsh in judging it until then. That said, I don't blame anyone who's – if this isn't for them and they speak out against it, I think that's valid and something AEW should want to hear, and MJF and Cole should want to hear, is the ride so upsetting or off-putting or not the tone that AEW fans look for, that it doesn't matter what the end is. I think for some fans, it's going to be a big turnoff for them. And, I mean, it is – I don't know. I mean, there was a lot going on there in the dance-off that I could see a lot of people just going, I can never look the same way at really any of them again. I mean, it's hard to unsee some of that stuff. And, you know, is it self-indulgent or is it entertaining and amusing with an end goal that sort of fits the aesthetic of what today's fans are willing to accept and even embrace? But it is sports entertainment-y, as that term is used. And, yeah. You know, Todd Martin's been talking about this on The Fix. You know, is that really how AEW is going to grow and differentiate itself from WWE, which is red hot right now, by trying to outdo them at the things that drove people to AEW in the first place?
Yeah, I mean, and part of me is looking at this in relationship to what we saw this weekend on Collision with, perhaps, you know, an unbelievable tag team match. And now basically a comedy duo is going to be taking on FTR, who had this historic match. And I don't know, obviously the angle, whatever angle they're working on is going to happen during that match. And I'm just hoping that FTR doesn't get buried by whatever they're doing with Cole and MJF. Whether it's maybe MJF starts abusing, you know, Dax or Harwood and Cole comes to the rescue. You know, I don't know. I mean, you know, it's just, I feel bad that FTR just had this fabulous match and now they're kind of getting pulled into this other thing. So, you know, that's just kind of my look at that.
Eric, you want to add anything else?
So my notes say, you know, after the first hour of this show tonight, you know, ending with MJF and Cole tag team match, it's like they're using a format sheet from Raw. It's mm-hmm. backstage sketch. It's outside the building sketch. It's backstage angle. I don't like the way WWE presents sports entertainment. I'm not going to yuck your yum if you do, but I prefer pro wrestling, right? Let me just get that on the record. I acknowledge WWE is super hot right now. They are – I am amazed that they are selling – they're 10,000-plus seats almost every week, twice a week, right, for the TV tapings. The house shows are doing gangbusters. The tickets are moving quickly. You got to get on them right away. And – I, you know, I get all that. It's just, I just don't like it, and it's not for me. And yep. I guess at the rate they're headed with AEW bringing in all these, you know, WWE experienced backstage people to sit at the table because they got to book so much TV, you know, twice as much TV now a week, you know, prime TV, right? Not Rampage or Dark, but like two hour shows. I guess this is where I become a collider, which is a sentence I never thought I would say, given how angry I remain at seeing
a collider. Yep. I mean, is there value in having differentiated brands and you know, an A/B test experiment and, you know, give people a reason to tune in one show and then get a, you know, have a very different vibe with different wrestlers on top on the other show?
Yeah, sure. I would prefer they go back to the non-WWE style. If they're going to keep Dynamite being the roller coaster that never stops and is just go, 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 right? You never get a chance to breathe. I'd prefer they do it that way instead of doing it the WWE way that they're doing, that they are now increasingly using and have been, truthfully, since the Revolution pay-per-view at the start of March.
Nick, back to you. Anything else you want to add or react to or comment on?
Last thing I'll just posit, going back to the Blood and Guts match, is I wonder if the BCC with Danielson being out a little bit longer than anticipated, Moxley tonight, and they had to really voice it a lot with the announcers because it wasn't quite clear until, I don't know if whether it was Taz or Excalibur, who spelled it out, is that Moxley surrendered to save Yuta. And
right.
They showed, you know, they zoomed in on Moxley and he had this, you know, look of you know, agony of defeat, the old, you know, ABC Wide World of Sports, you know, the skier going off the ski slope. He survived, by the way. But is it possible that they're, you know, a slow move for the Blackpool Combat Club to go go face again, or at least hard, you know, tough face to counter who's the manager, the bald guy?
Don Keller.
That group, as well as whatever, you know, there's other groups and stuff that the Moxley is, they're going to turn Moxley back because he's still popular, whether he's a heel or not. I mean, he gets huge cheers when he comes in, and they got, maybe they're thinking at Wembley, they want him to come out and get, you know, just cheers for cheers' sake. So I'm just wondering. I mean, it seemed that's not something 4 weeks ago that the Blackpool Combat Club would be known for, is if you're going to die in the ring, you're going to die in the ring, and that's fine. Go ahead and die. Not really, but I mean, that was their mentality, is just, we beat people up, we beat ourselves up, and that's what we do, you know. But this was different. This was slightly different.
Yeah, Eric, anything else on that?
I do not, no.
All right.
Okay,
cool.
I just
Nick,
wanted
yeah.
to pose it.
Yeah, and, no, I appreciate it.
And I'll listen to the rest of the show. I can't wait to hear the on-site correspondent. I'm just curious because the crowd sounded great, and it looked good, too. So
yeah,
I will leave it
yeah.
there.
Well, Nick, thanks so much for your perspective on things, and I think it's a needed point of view. And yeah, I mean, you're not alone. You're not alone. And the feedback we're getting by email and social media and other reactions, it's just, there's some consternation, Eric, with some choices that are being made right now. Nick, we'll talk to you soon.
Okay, great. Have a good night.
Yeah, thanks a lot. Yep, enjoy your week. All right, our number is 347-215-8558. We'd love to hear from you. If you're live streaming the show, give us a call, 347-215-8558, push 1 after you call, or email wadekellerpodcast@pwtorch.com. All right, we've got a Taylor in Boston, Mass. On deck, but first things first, LaMarcus in D.C. LaMarcus, welcome. Thanks for calling. What's on your mind about Dynamite tonight?
Hi. Hey, Wade. Hey, Eric. I want to continue with the MJF stuff. I do walk better for MJF. And I'm not sure if it's like self-sabotage going on or what, but I think of last week, I think you and your co-host mentioned that MJF seems like he's auditioning for WWE, like all the time, like everything he does is sort of auditioning for a future in WWE. And if that's the case, I feel like if Tony had his hands on this, this would be Tony sort of murking up MJF to sort of ruin his future with going to WWE, because I don't understand why they are going about this way. MJF, I know he's a heel. I mean, just like everyone sort of said, pretty much assume that either he's going to turn on Cole or Cole's going to turn on him. But I think the way they're going to it is just detrimental. It's not really helping either person. And again, this is with MJF, so it's like if he turns, we all expect it, because, you know, he said he's a double, which to me, I never see this double version of MJF, because he, even when he's sort of serious, it's kind of I guess it kind of reminds me of The Miz. When Miz gets serious, you can't really take him all that serious, because it's so much, he does so much comedy, it kind of hurts him when he's trying to get serious, I feel like. If he's trying to, I guess my question is, do you think it would be better if MJF has more of a blood feud, kind of in the vein of Seth Rollins and Finn Balor, because his whole title reign is just, I don't know, it's just sort of, I guess, uneventful, if I guess it's the best way I could put it, but it is, what do you think, I guess, what you guys think MJF needs as far as his title reign too? Do you think he needs to get more serious, if he needs to just drop the thing? I feel like if he was more like Triple H, you know, Triple H when he was like, I guess, the Gang, and I guess the Cerebral Assassin, if he was more that type of character, it'll make more sense to me, but that's not what he's doing, but...
LaMarcus, I've said before that if you know, Triple H or Stone Cold Steve Austin could play the banjo, I don't think they should have added it to their act, even if they had talent or if they could tap dance. I don't think it should be added to their act. MJF has a lot of range, and it seems like he's showing off. I think he's got an itch he wants to scratch in terms of doing comedy and zany stuff and dancing and singing and all of that. But what's best for his character is something that he's very excellent at, I would argue, which is being a modern-day, old-school, consistent heel who matches Tony Schiavone's utter disgust with him constantly. And I love Schiavone going, oh, man, it's repulsive watching MJF shake hands with fans at ringside. He's so insincere. He's the only voice of reason right now because Excalibur doesn't have opinions. And, you know, Taz sort of, you know, chuckling along and doesn't want to, you know, like show his hand because he would be on team MJF Deception if MJF is doing that. But Schiavone is you know, kind of tipping the hand or winking, not winking to the audience, but letting him know. We know what he's up to, even if you're enjoying this. But it doesn't help Adam Cole if Adam Cole doesn't see it coming. And the story is Roderick Strong knows what's happening. You know, Roderick Strong's not like it's not like Roderick Strong is, we're supposed to look at him as like a humorless stick in the mud. He's a guy who's seen clearly, but what's the argument? Adam Cole is naive, or he's playing MJF also, and it's going to turn out that he outplayed MJF at the game. I don't know. And that's why I say I'm along for the ride. I want to see what rents before coming down on it. But my inclination, Eric, and I think about this, is what LaMarcus is asking about. My inclination is MJF narrowing the focus of his character and being just a despicable badass heel who is really entertaining in that role, but don't broaden the range of that character as much as he does. What do you think?
Well, they had a problem after All Out last year in September when CM Punk wins the belt in his hometown and he gets stepped on, his moment gets stepped on by MJF, who gets cheered in Chicago. CM Punk's you know, hometown, as MJF is, you know, has the devil mask on and is being a heel. And then they had to spend weeks and months of MJF doing low common denominator, insult the local sports team stuff to get booed again, right? It was a uphill climb for them. And so now they're going back to this, and, you know, you're confusing the fan base a little bit. Roderick Strong wandering around as a human plot device. If Cole truly is not the dumb babyface and he is going to do MJF before MJF does him, which we've seen glimpses of that, right? MJF took the birthday cake to the face, not Adam Cole, right? Adam Cole knew it was coming. Does Cole not clue in his friend Roderick Strong that he's working MJF? Is MJF auditioning for WWE? Well, in storyline, MJF's contract is up at the end of 2023, and he's talking about the bidding war of 24. Doesn't do that as much as he used to. Huh. But if MJF is truly not signed to a contract extension, then he has pulled off one of the biggest swindles ever in the business on Tony Khan, right? If he has this run on top where he's on TV and he showed his range and auditioned to get a big deal from WWE and he walks, well, then Tony Khan will be exposed as a big dumb guy. And I don't think Tony Khan's a big dumb guy. So I'm going to guess MJF's contract is signed. The other thing I hated was the skit they had at the Chinese restaurant. It just sucked. It was like something straight out of NXT, specifically Zoe Stark and Io Sky going to a sushi restaurant in 2019 with less barfing, right? It was just not what I want out of pro wrestling. And I would say take heart, those of you who don't like this angle, which in my feedback is we certainly seem to be in the minority. People really seem to be into this. MJF will my booking prediction is MJF retains at All in London in late August, and then the following week loses to Punk in Chicago. at All Out at the United Center. That would be that would be my guess as to where this is going. So then MJF maybe gets downcycled a little bit after that.
LaMarcus, back to you. Any follow up on anything Erica and I said, or do you want to add to it or change topics?
Yeah, I mean, yeah, I'm along for the ride. Also, it's just I just don't like the storyline they're doing. But yeah, I'm along for the ride. Also, I like to imagine that the dance battle that they had when the music abruptly cut off and they were tapped by Sammy and they were tapped by the other team. I like to think that Tony Khan, when he saw like the live rating numbers, and he saw them dropping doing that dance battle, and he just told them to cut the music and just start the match. Because, like I mentioned earlier, I almost fast forward through the entire thing. But I was like, let me just power through and just keep watching. But it was just a lot. I don't know. And the Roddy Strong sort of the backstage session when he walked in on Renee and she was like, "There's anything you want to add?" And Roddy's like, "Not now, Renee." And I was like, "Damn, get out of her way there. You're walking into her like job space, like you're telling her like not now." But you know, that was just kind of funny to me.
All right, Marcus, what's your next point or question?
Sorry, yeah, the Blood and Guts match. I listened to the conference call they had yesterday, and they mentioned that one of the people asked them, "What if do they think Blood and Guts? That's funny that they think Blood and Guts could be his own pay per view." And he was saying that Blood and Guts is a pay per view caliber show, and I think that if that question was asked tomorrow, I mean, if the scrum happened tomorrow, they wouldn't ask that question because this Blood and Guts did not live up to the previous one. I'm just glad I know this kind of something you guys have mentioned earlier. But that's all I had other than the Jungle Boy hook segment. I feel like it would have been bigger if Dominic didn't win the title in NXT yesterday, but I kind of was expected, but that's all I have, to be honest.
Yeah, cool. Yeah, so we haven't talked about Jungle Boy yet. I'm glad LaMarcus brought it up so we don't get too deep into the show before covering it. It was, I think, a highlight of the show. Like, Jungle Boy Jack Perry, I don't know about Beethoven's entrance theme for him as a heel. I've got to still kind of figure that out. But it's good to move away from Tarzan Boy because it's just a babyface song. But he seems like kind of a natural heel. Like, it's working. Now it helps to be opposite of Hook, who, you know, is just kind of cool and certainly unoffensive, to personality-wise. And I thought Hook had easily his best performance. It felt like a full-fledged match, not a novelty exhibition, which, frankly, his matches have felt like so far. So to me, that worked, and I was encouraged about Jungle Boy seeming like he's going to be feel comfortable being a heel and effective when there's a lot of things pointing the other direction. And Hook seems like he's a full-fledged professional wrestler at this point. Eric, what do you think?
I was surprised it was that good, given that Jack Perry is freshly a heel and that Hook does not have a track record of selling a lot in matches he's been in by design. And Jack Perry is altering his offense, right? Because his offense was pure babyface offense,
yep.
Right?
Yep.
And he changed his offense to be less babyfacey and more heelish, attacks outside the ring, that kind of thing. I sure hope they got permission to fight in the crowd, Wade. I told the producer. I hope they did. The other thing is I had no idea what was going on in the opening with the Jack Perry getting in a limo in the desert. I didn't understand.
Supposed to think he's burying the old Jungle Boy?
Okay.
I mean, it's a total guess. I don't think it's obvious. That was just my
– I mean, there was no – you would have had to be heavy-handed then, like WWE, and show Jack Perry with a shovel in his hand and a hole in the ground, patting the dirt on top of it. I might have gotten it then, but your guess is as good as mine. I will say this. So AEW spent a ton of money on the Final Countdown for Danielson as his entrance music at Double or at Forbidden Door 2. And then they spent a ton of money on Sympathy for the Devil for MJF at All Out last year. Now they're reaching into the public domain for their theme song. Beethoven's Fifth is totally free. You don't need money to pay Beethoven money. And the same is true for Don Callis / Takeshita's theme song. It's just like one note, one dark note, you know, that plays out or is repeated, right? That's probably in the public domain too. So Tony Khan cheaping it out after blowing through the music budget.
Yep. I mean, do what works regardless. Well, not regardless of the price. I mean, if you can afford more, then do more. But yeah, I mean, it's trying to average out the price of things. It's like you go grocery shopping, you buy some expensive, you know, things that you really like, and then you try to, you know, even it out by having some, you know, peanut butter jelly sandwiches every other day. If that's the only way you can justify the budget of some expensive higher end price point. And maybe Tony's trying to average out his entrance music budget by doing that. What did you come away with in terms of Hook as somebody who I think moved past some reservations that I had, which is I was just worried that he wasn't getting featured in longer matches because he just didn't really have a knack for it. He was going to be who was the guy in the 80s? McGee, who's like this great athlete. Tom McGee, yeah. All this hype. He looked the part. He's a great athlete, but he just couldn't. He just didn't have he had two left feet. Like he just didn't have the rhythm needed for a pro wrestler. And I was starting to worry like that Hook. They just determined he just for some reason it just he couldn't like bump naturally or whatever. And it's like he looked like a good young up and coming wrestler, and you know Perry's really good too. But is to me like what I saw tonight means it's time to like get serious about giving Hook more matches and more TV time. You got 5 hours of TV a week, you know, two sets of 2 hour A shows. Figure out a way to make him one of these center kind of I don't know centerpiece acts is overstating it, but one of the people that you tune in either Wednesday or Saturday because you know he's going to be part of something. And I just think there's something there with him. And now that he had this match, I'm like, don't hold back anymore. We're a year and a half past the peak, but you can get a new peak.
Tom McGee, two left feet, unless he was in there with Bret Hart, who made him look like $1 million and got him a magazine cover of WWE, I think, as a proto Ultimate Warrior before there was the Ultimate Warrior. So Hook, I mean, it wouldn't surprise me if he didn't have they were trying to hide him because he was still training, right? He's been training pretty much through most of AEW, and there are some limitations to his act at the moment. He's undersized, right? He's like a junior heavyweight, and they've got him basically being Brock Lesnar and Bill Goldberg, right? This kind of previously undefeated, his matches don't last too long, badass. And he doesn't talk, so yet, for the most part. So those are two... before you go featuring him, in a prominent role on any of the shows, I guess I'd want to figure that out. You know, that said, I didn't think they made a big enough deal about this being Hook's first loss, right?
I mean, they underlined it at the end. You know, this ends his undefeated streak in AEW.
They did protect him with the visual pin, right? Hook got a 7 count or whatever on Perry, You know, the other nice note I liked about this match was Perry cheated to win using the belt shot, which he refused to do it at Double or Nothing, and it cost him, right, leading to his heel turn. So that was a nice note.
Yeah, good point.
Attention to details. So, but yeah, I guess I'd pump the brakes on Hook, and maybe they've got that figured out, right? I didn't think Orange Cassidy would expand beyond his sort of indie comedy gimmick role, and he's one of the most valuable television players for that company. So maybe they got something similar planned for Hook. So I'll let that play out.
Yeah. Yep. Yeah. All right. Very good. We'll move to Taylor in Boston next. Taylor, welcome. What are your thoughts on Dynamite tonight? Good to hear from you again.
Hey, what's going on, Wade? I was actually at the show tonight. I thought it was a great show. I thought it was a great show. It reminded me of like the earlier Dynamites I went to in Boston, but like the crowd was like, you could like feel the electricity in the crowd before the show started. The last few times they were here, I didn't feel that, so I was happy to see that, you know. And they had a pretty good showing attendance wise, so it was fun. It was a good time.
Tell us about the dance off and your opinion on it, and then also that what you observed around you. You know, they on television they cut to fans who were laughing and smiling and having a jolly good time watching this you know, zaniness of these four break from the normal mold. But when they went to wide shots, what I observed is some people were into it, and others were kind of like, what's happening here? I'm not sure what's happening here. So tell me in the building what it felt like when that was going on. Was it just mega over, or was it mixed, or what?
it was definitely mixed. It was kind of like, what's happening here with the dance break? So normally I would hate everything about that dance break and not be a fan of anything about this MJF and Adam Cole thing, but it just makes me laugh so goddamn hard, these two together, that I'm just kind of along for the ride just to kind of see where it's going.
Yeah. I mean, that's, in the zone that I'm in when I watch it. It's like, because MJF and Cole have chemistry. I think they don't look like they're drag kicking and screaming into doing this. I think, Sammy and I assume Guevara and Garcia were trying to be corny and not great, but that might have been the result of trying really hard to be good, and they just couldn't be. Garcia's head popping up in between the thighs of Guevara was not something I expected to see on wrestling. That was quite the freeze frame moment there. Someone, if they tweeted that picture out and you didn't have context, you'd be like, okay, what's going on? What is happening here? Even if you watched it, you're still wondering what's going on, what's happening here. So it seemed like they were willing to be foils, is my point, and kind of make fools of themselves, even if they're sort of, I don't know what to call it with Jericho, but in a situation where they seem like they're meant to be more sympathetic relative to Jericho and hanging out at restaurants with Callis and stuff. So I don't know what to make of any of it, but it is interesting, like, that it seems like the crowd's into it, but it's sort of like that thing that you're into, and then when it's done, you're like, was that good judgment? Like, it was kind of fun to get wrapped up in it, but what the heck did I just watch, and I don't know how I feel about it. I don't know. But yeah, Taylor, go ahead. Any other observations?
Yeah, I think at the beginning of it was just more kind of like, all right, what's happening here? And then I feel like once the crowd kind of realized what was happening, I know my section, I was in the bottom bowl, like right middle on the ring. I mean, I know the guys around me and the people I was, we were all laughing. But, like I said, I'm kind of just along for the ride with this angle. It just makes me laugh. They just make me laugh. I don't know why. Something about MJF being underneath Adam Cole on the ring apron when they do the boom. It's so stupid. It just makes me laugh so hot. And then I just want to give a little context, too, to that skit that they did. So that restaurant they're at is like an iconic Boston restaurant called the Kowloon. Unless you're from the Boston area, you kind of wouldn't get the reference of them being there. But that restaurant is like an iconic Chinese food restaurant in Boston. Like, it's the restaurant that all the wrestlers go to after the shows. When you're a kid, after the show at the Garden, you have your parents drive you to the Kowloon because that's where the wrestlers are. That's where they're eating. That's where they're drinking. That's where they come out. John Cena actually wore special edition Air Force One Kowloon sneakers at WrestleMania this year. Like, that's how iconic that restaurant is. So when they showed the Kowloon inside the Garden, the place went nuts for it.
Yeah. Interesting. Okay. Yeah. I mean, I didn't know any of that, but I also assumed basically that. You know what I mean? Like, it felt like they were, it was an iconic place. It wasn't just some random, random place at a big box strip mall or something.
Yeah.
So tell us about how the Hook Jack Perry match went over with a live crowd. Was the crowd just, super into Hook and very against Perry? Did they hold the attention of the fans for what was quite a long match, especially for Hook?
Yeah, so that match live was awesome. Everyone was into it. As soon as Jungle Boy came out, the place was booing him out of the business, booing him out of the building. His new entrance music is absurd. I don't even once they started playing it, I was like, what is this? I was like, I don't know if I love this or I hate this. I feel like having Perry kind of show his new gimmick and his, his heel gimmick with the new black pants and the new music, I feel like it was a Boston was, or like an East Coast city was probably a good place to debut that. Because he was getting booed out of the building and every time I see Hook live, everybody loves Hook, and I agree with you 100%. Like, it's time to, like, like my, you know, sorry to swear, but like my grandmother used to say, it's time to shit, I got off the pot with Hook. You know, let's see what this kid's got. Because every
well,
time I see him live, the place goes wild for him. And you know, I've never been a big Jungle Boy fan. I always kind of thought he was a little lame, but you know, I was kind of happy for him that it was like, oh hey, this is working. You know what I mean? He's getting booed. Like it's kind of getting over. I was happy for him because if it didn't work, it would have been rough.
This wasn't the A topic from the show, but how did Britt Baker's reaction resonate with you? Where do you think she is with a big crowd and a major market? Did she get a star reaction or something other than that?
Yes, I mean she got a pretty good reaction. I think the crowd was a little confused with how quick the match was. I think that some people were kind of waiting for something to happen after. So after she won, it was kind of like, okay, like what's happening now? I mean, if you know, Mercedes Moné wasn't injured, I think that might have been a time where people might have thought she might have came out because she's from Boston. But it was just kind of weird. I just felt like it was kind of one of those matches that was kind of like, hey, don't forget about me. You know what I mean? She got a good reaction, but it was weird. It was just awkward.
How did the Blood and Guts match play for you live? Did it drag at all ever? Was it just the crowd was into it start to finish? You know, we on TV had a 4K HD close-up view of things that didn't look as good, or sometimes like some of the, you know, the nail bed and the glass sort of was fakey. They missed some camera angles. So there's little things that kind of from a TV standpoint didn't work, but I'm curious from a live perspective where you kind of got to choose where you looked and you didn't have commercial breaks and there wasn't a director choosing where you were looking and you didn't get close-ups of like, you know, the fake broken glass. Did it like just resonate really well start to finish?
So live, I thought it was good, not great. It definitely lagged a little bit. Whenever they bring out the glass, I roll my eyes because it's so obvious. It's like sugar glass or some sort of gimmick. I didn't really see the nail bed too up close. I mean, the place went nuts when people were getting thrown on. I mean, obviously we weren't able to see it up close. I'm guessing from what you say, it didn't look that great. Live, I thought it was good, not great. I was expecting a little bit more.
Yeah. Yep. What else, Taylor? Any other thoughts on anything on the show tonight or anything you want to share? Including like fan chants. They're chanting for tables. They got it. They chanted for fire. They didn't get it. I'm curious what would have come next or was something next.
We Want Fire, I thought was funny. My section actually started that. I thought that was really funny. I didn't want fire. I on the record, I didn't want fire. After that Cody Rhodes fire incident, I'm all set with fire. I thought it was a great show. Like I said, I felt that like the electricity was back in the building, and I hadn't really felt that the last few times that they were in Boston. And I was happy that they ran the Garden, and I was happy that they had a good showing. I'm hoping that finally, eventually, Tony Khan will bring a pay-per-view to Boston. I mean, throw us a Revolution. Give us anything. I mean, Chicago's a great town, but it's like enough already with Chicago. Can you spread the wealth a little bit? but other than that, I thought it was a good show. The merchandise stands were horrible as usual. I don't understand. I don't understand the thinking of the merch stands there. I was in line getting a food and a beer, and the merch stand behind me started like getting really, really crowded. And I'm like, what are these people waiting for? The shirts are horrible. And then I get my beer and I get my hot dog and I start walking, and John Cena's dad is there taking photos with people. And I'm like, this guy,
oh
man. I'm like, this guy.
I love it.
So it was it was pretty funny to see that.
Wow. Eric, you want to jump in with any question for Taylor?
Sure. So this was at the Fleet Center, and they were, I think, according to WrestleTix, they were approaching 9,000 tickets sold as of their last update. So I think probably it holds probably close to 20 for basketball, but with a wrestling TV setup, you're probably looking at 14 or 15 max that you could pack in there. How did the arena look? Were there like big, like tarped off sections that were empty? Were there empty seats throughout it? It looked full on TV.
So the bottom bowl was completely full. And then the balcony section where the hard camera is was completely topped off. And then the balcony section where the hard camera faced was probably, I don't know, maybe 60% full, 60, 70% full. It was loud in there. It was loud. I mean, I've been to the Garden for, you know, games and other wrestling. And, when it was...
Anything else, sir?
No. I mean, I think this was probably the second or third biggest TV taping attendance for AEW this year. They had that in January. They were in L.A., and they had that big gate, and then they had Punk's return at the United Center, which is probably right around what Boston did. So I think all told from a box office perspective, a pretty big success tonight for AEW.
Taylor, anything else? Taylor dropped off. Okay. Might have lost our connection with him. He might call back. But we got a lot of good conversation from there. We still got Mike McMahon coming as an on-site correspondent. He's staying for the Rampage taping, so we'll get some insight into that too. Eric, or you said something that really upset him. So, you know, mull that over.
I mean, it's my brand, so.
Yes. All right. He did just call back, so let's bring him on in case you've got any further thoughts. We thought it was something Eric said, Taylor.
No, sorry, I'm driving home. I hit a dead spot. I don't know where I got cut off, but I heard the question, and so in terms of attendance, the entire bottom bowl was full.
We heard like almost everything, I think.
Oh, perfect.
We got perfect. We got you were only gone for like 10 seconds.
Okay. All right. Perfect.
Yeah.
I mean, if you don't have any more questions for me, thanks for having me on as always. I always like enjoy calling in when I head to the shows in Boston.
Yeah, that's great. Anything else you want to share? Your thoughts on anything else on the show before we send you off back driving?
I will say somebody had a sign that said Wheeler Yuta disappoints me, which I thought was like sign of the night. I don't know if anyone saw that on TV, but that was a great sign. And then the back of the sign said, "The guy behind me can't see," which I thought was really funny too. I thought that was an A+ sign of the night.
I like that. All right, cool. Taylor, glad I asked. Thanks, and call anytime.
All right, thanks, Wade. Bye.
Yep, you bet. All right, our number 347-215-8558. We got Mike McMahon right around the corner, and we got some emails to get to, but it is Javier time. Eric, should we play Javier's music or not? It's your call.
I don't want to be the heel, so I'll give the green light to that. Oh, my God, Javier with the theme music every time. Good Lord, what an ego on this man.
Nice.
Well, I mean, we got to get Mike his residual, so.
That's right, Mike Myers, yes. All right,
so,
Javier. Good. It's always good when you call up.
Yeah, I'm starting to.
What do you
want to
talk about? So what do you want to talk about, Javier? You made me do it.
You stole it from me because I was saving that one for myself. Wait, I was saving that one. It just exhausted out of from wrestling. I kind of was hoping more from this Blood and Guts match. I was kind of hoping it'd be more like ladder-esque kind of spots, that kind of stuff, than it being a death match because particularly after the exciting encounter Doomsday No DQ match and Final Death Match in New Japan, where you had some similar spots. So But overall, I think it was good. I did like the psychology of the bad guys leaving. You know, evil always turns on itself. It's self-defeating. So I like the idea that, you know, you have two heels are like, you know, we're not going to get together. Meanwhile, the baby faces, because they're legitimately friends. You know, one of them coming all the way from Japan to help out his friends, them sticking together to win there at the end. I did like that. The Moxley being the one who surrendered was kind of, that part was a little bit weird, since, you know, like a previous caller said that, you know, you would expect Moxley to be, you know, the one to save, you know, fight to the death. So that was a bit weird. But other than that, I did overall, I liked it enough, but not like I was hoping for more.
Yeah, I think that you put it well when it's like it was a little too heavy on the death match aspect, and I don't know. I mean, this was in no way a top tier War Games Blood and Guts match, but it is so novel and different, and they don't, you know, run into the ground. It's once a year, and there are a lot of big names in it. But yeah, it wasn't just the production aspect that was, you know, there was elements of it that just felt disjointed, and like we said, like it just felt like Hangman Page was like just missing for a while. Where's he been? All of a sudden he's there. And Javier Cota Ibushi, what do you think about his role? I led with that with Eric near the top of the show.
Well, I did not want to say anything, but so I'm glad that Eric said it. I was thinking that same thing. I did a double take. I'm like, did they lose Cota Ibushi and bring in a body double for a moment? That was my thought. I was like, maybe I built them up. It's been a long time since I've seen them. Maybe I built them up in my head, but I am glad that, Eric, that you brought it up so I didn't have to.
Yeah. Go ahead, Eric.
I'm always the heel.
Eric, talk with Javier.
Javier, go ahead and keep going. Tick through your points so then we can react to them.
go ahead, because I want to, you know, go ahead.
Well, I did some research before the show started, and if past history is any guide, the previous two Blood and Gut shows popped a rating for AEW. In 2021, we had the Pinnacle over the Inner Circle, and it did 1.09 million viewers, this is during the pandemic, at Daly's Place, just before the return to touring, 547,000 in 18 to 49 for a 0.42 rating in the key demographic, number one for the night on cable. It got 4.5 stars of the Wrestling Observer and just 7.5 out of 10 on Cage Match, which means that's a 3.75 score. And then in 2022, Blackpool Combat Club is the faces over the Jericho Appreciation Society in 45 minutes, 1.023 million viewers, 472,000 in 18 to 49. For a 0.36 rating, again, number one for the night on cable. And that one rated 4.75 in the Observer star-wise and 8.4 out of 10. So 4.24 stars from the Cage Match voters. I would put this one, I don't know, 4.25. I mean, I just was not.
I wouldn't go. Well, I mean, I'm harder. To me, 4.25 is like match of the year candidate. This, I think what you mean is 3.25.
On the Wade scale, sure.
Yes. The more sane scale. In three, there's no shame in 3.25. It just means it's a good match, but it had some low point, some good stuff, and that put it over, that made it for sure above average and an enjoyable spectacle match, but some things that kept it from being in that elite 4-star territory that should be, you know, really mean something, not devalued.
You would have expected going in that, given the creative minds associated with this match and the time they gave them, that they would have achieved
entered
higher
4 stars.
Than they did.
They would have gotten to 4 stars, but they didn't. Oh wait, you said they did. Sorry.
In the more mainstream scale, not the Bizarro World Wade Stingy scale. Yes. Yeah. But either way, it's all relative, right? We're basically in the same place.
Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah. Javier, where were you on the match as a whole?
Well, my scale is definitely more the Stingy Wade Keller scale, 3.25 about. You know, I generally prefer just to round it to the half, so I'd probably even give this one a three because I was really hoping for something more. And, you know, going into this, I was like, okay, so what is Kota Ibushi going to do to kill himself? And he didn't do anything, you know, so, which, I mean, in a way is a positive, but, you know, he also, you know, didn't do anything. I'm wondering, it's just because, you know, he had talked about it'll probably be a while before he did anything else and he was going to concentrate on school. So I'm wondering if they just, you know, like, you know, talked him into it before he could, you know, turn himself into a granite god, as you described him, Eric.
Yeah, he did do something after the show went off the air. He took a back bump on the glass or the thumbtacks, and it was walking around with a whole bunch of glass or thumbtacks. It was hard for me to tell. In the post match. So, better late than never, I guess.
But yeah, I thought it was fine. On the MJF
Cole
thing. Huh?
You were struggling to come up with what you're going to talk about, and I knew what it was, so I said MJF Cole.
Okay.
I wanted to prompt you. I know you well enough to know what's next.
All right, cool. So yeah, on the MJF Cole front, I'm liking it. I'm not gonna argue whether it's good or for business or not. Whether this is what you want your top title to be on, be doing. But yeah, I as far as the day-to-day stuff, I like it. I like the idea that one of the things I like about wrestling is when you convince the people to want something that's utterly ludicrous, like, getting over the idea of them hitting a double clothesline and the crowd really being into the double clothesline spot,
successful.
Stuff like that. Yeah, it's, because, I mean, that's one of the things I love about, Chris Jericho, where he, the time that the bet was about if he could get the word it over.
Mm-hmm.
Do you remember? Yeah, he got the word it over, getting the list over, just like the stupid stuff and get people invested in it. And then it works well because, then when it gets taken away, you're going to be upset at the guy taking it away. So people are invested in this, and granted, the question would be what percentage of the people of the audience watch it are invested. That's a separate question.
Right.
So the people who are invested in the storyline, they're really invested in it. They're really invested in the chemistry between these two, between MJF and Cole. And when I'm assuming MJF, who's going to be the heel, when he takes it away from the fans, they're going to hate him for it. An example of that was the whole list thing with Kevin Owens, when Kevin Owens gives Jericho a list and it's the list of KO, and the only name on there was Jericho's. You could hear the audience just like, say, oh no, we don't want this right now because we've been joining them so much. So that's what you could, basically get out of this. Obviously with the caveat being, like I said, that how many people need to get invested in that relationship to begin with.
Mm-hmm. Eric, what do you think about that? Because it does seem like MJF's kind of trying to be Jericho and KO and, tap into that aspect of things, going back to what Javier said kind of at the beginning about, getting something like a double clothesline over. And it, does feel like, hey, that's a challenge and it's working. You can imagine them feeling somewhat validated, but it doesn't change the preamble or caveat that everybody seems to be giving, which is, yeah, I enjoyed it, but I'm not sure it's the right thing to be doing, and it could be turning people off.
Just because I don't like it doesn't mean it's not over. And in 2023, what we've learned is what's over is over.
Right.
The only thing that really matters in wrestling is how much of a TV deal you can get. And how much of a TV deal you can get, financially is based on how many eyeballs you're drawing. And if that's helping AEW's ratings, then they are and it's over with the fans. You can have a bunch of old crusty purists like me. And I generally, I defended Orange Cassidy, maybe not Danhausen, but, I've defended a lot of AEW nonsense over the years as it's over.
But it wasn't the world champion.
Yeah, it wasn't the world champion, and it wasn't so WWE-like, and I think that's my problem with it. But, what works, works. And, it was funny to me that Daniel Garcia did the job to a double clothesline that, looked fairly weak, mm-hmm. And wouldn't be a finisher in any other match. And he's challenging Shibata for the ROH Pure title on Friday night's pay-per-view. So not a lot of building up of Danny Garcia before that match, but that's not a hill I'm willing to die on or anything. I don't ultimately think it matters, but it's just interesting that they twisted the main event just to get a Claudio Pac angle, but they couldn't protect Daniel Garcia before his ROH pure title match on Friday.
Javier, anything else on that or anything else on anything?
Well, and then the I did like also, I'll echo everything with the former Jungle Boy, Jack Perry, dressing somebody up in the Jungle Boy outfit and then burying him in the desert. So hopefully that was like a doll or something and not a real person that he did that to. But I am glad that the symbolism of him saying, you know, it's over, playing the song one last time and then switching over to, I mean, if you're going to go with classic, Beethoven's Fifth is a little bit weird. It's not what I would consider for a wrestling, you know, Ride of the Valkyries or something, you know, even the 1812, you know, Claudio's 1812 Overture is something, but, you know, Beethoven's Fifth is just kind of weird. Doesn't really sound like wrestling-wise, particularly unless he's going to be doing like a virtuoso kind of gimmick, which I don't think is what he's going to do. They're probably better, better stuff that they could use for that.
Yeah, yep. What do you do with Hook going forward now?
I mean, I'm assuming they're going to continue this with Jack Perry for the time being. I mean, he looked fine to me. So I don't know. He's got that loss, that pesky loss out of the way. So, you know, now you can make him more human, but just, you know, keep him. You know, I need to see how this feud with Jack Perry develops before, you know, really knowing where do you go from here. I am, you know, assuming that's going to continue, considering the, you know, Kaz on commentary being very involved. Maybe you end up getting, you know, Taz working with Hook in, like, you know, segments or something, you know, getting back to the drawing board kind of thing, because it looked like Taz's commentary. I mean, granted, Taz is Taz, so maybe he's just, you know, going over the top with his stuff, but, you know, it felt like he was good. He was more engaged with this, and it is his title that now you've got on, you know, this basic pretty boy in Jack Perry. You know, so I think there might be something with that.
Yeah. Yep. You know what I meant to ask is do you have any better idea of where you think MJF Cole is going to land?
Well, I mean, I share your concern where if it's a straight up screw job from MJF, that's going to be, I don't want Cole to look like an idiot. That's the important thing. It's got to either be he does attack, but Cole's ready for it, or it could just be like almost like a breakup between friends where they do get into it in a shoving match, and they essentially turn on each other kind of thing where you know they blame each other and they start pushing each other around. I mean, you could go as far as Cole saying, you know, I'm done with this, turn his back, and then get Cole cocked, you know, just for the heat. But he needs to be already, like, he needs to have made the decision that, okay, you know, he's going to be against me, even though, you know, and assuming that, I'm going to assume that his friendship is genuine to him, you know, towards the MJF, that he sees something in him, but, you know, is also prepared for the person he really is, so he sees all of MJF as opposed to just, you know, part of him. And, you know, particularly, like, you know, I'd like to see him actually take out MJF, you know, when all is said and done, whether there's a title change or not, but ultimately go over in the storyline on MJF in some way, shape, or form, and then say, hey, look, you know, my friendship, the olive branch I extended to you was genuine. I genuinely thought there was good in you, but you just can't get, can't get out of your own way. So you could have legitimately had a friend that you've never had, but because you're MJF, you screwed that and you pissed it away. So that's kind of where I'm hoping it goes. But, you know, I think the one more in danger than anybody else would be Cole if he's just like an idiot who gets, you know, taken out. Because, I mean, they pulled it off with the Jericho thing because it wasn't, you know, he came to the realization, but, you know, so it didn't like kill Jericho. You wanted Jericho as the babyface to be KO during that storyline. And even like, you know, you could also put it in current context, the whole thing about, you know, having people want something, because that's one of the things that got, you know, the Bloodline story over, is because what the people wanted was the friendship between Jay and Sami Zayn, you know, with the whole, you know, he's not Usy thing. And then, so that was a big part of it, is that people wanted to see those two get together. Which is why the whole, you know, that's why that whole part with Sami Zayn worked, because once Sami Zayn had to make his decision, people still wanted Jay to be with him, and they were hoping that Jay would join Sami, and that's driven that whole story, getting people to want that. So you could do that not only with the silly stuff, like, you know, getting the double clothesline over, but you could also, you know, it's probably more effective if you're doing it something like an interpersonal relationship. Let me remove the property. It is more effective when you do it with real things like, interpersonal relationships.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. So, yeah. Anything else up here?
Well, my brother texted me two things. Give me 1 second because I because he was watching it a little bit late. Give me 1 second. The first one was I'm watching the dance-off on AEW, and I could literally hear Todd Martin screaming from here. And the other one was AR Fox is getting another title shot.
Oh, that was weird. Yeah, that's a weird way to get a title shot, you know? Yeah.
You know, I mean, literally, has every single time AR – I mean, I liked AR Fox. I had been following Evolve. And he was like, you know, one of the main stays there. So I liked the stuff he was doing. He also was in Lucha Underground for a bit, I believe. So I liked him, but it's like, this is like what, the 10th time he's been on TV, and they've all been some sort of title match.
Yeah, I think his only win on AEW TV proper TV might have been in that Trios Battle Royal.
Yeah, so that's pretty much all I had. Although I do have if you don't mind asking, Eric. So what do you real quick? What do you think about New Japan thus far? The G1 climax.
Well, I got through 5 matches of Night 4, which was the show today for us, yesterday for them at this point, and I have been wholly underimpressed. Not
overall
big fan of what they've been doing so far. I don't think it's been very good. There's been one good match, Will Ospreay and Taichi, and I guess the battle between Shota and Tsuji was pretty. Shota and Ren, the draw was pretty good as well. What I have not had a chance to listen to your audio yet. Where have you landed?
Yeah, the AMB block nights, I think, have been pretty dismal. The only thing that they've they have the best things, which have been the I'm just calling the Reiwa 3 stuff, which is Yota Tsuji, Ren Narita, and Shota Umino. Both of Ren Narita's matches I was really high on. The one with Yota Tsuji and the one with Shota. And that's all for those two nights. I did think that the C and D block, they have been on average better, but nothing like stellar, you know, blow me out of the water kind of stuff. But yeah, so that's just pretty much where I've been overall.
I think a lot of that is the 20-minute time limit puts a ceiling on how good a match can be. I think they're probably adjusting to that, because in New Japan, if you're going to get a 4.5 star on a normal mainstream scale, a 1 star on the weight scale, match, you
Javier came in lower than me, so it's the new Javier scale.
You're going to go longer than 20 minutes, and they're not doing that until the playoffs, to the quarterfinal round. So, I think that's going to put a lid on the number of great matches. That plus the fact that there's 32 wrestlers, many of whom don't deserve to be anywhere in sniffing distance of a G1. But.
And the C and D and block, I think, have been handling, with the exception of the, you know, the two that went to the draw on the A and B block, the C and D block, I think they've manipulated the better, because when it's when the match goes into the 15 minutes, it played into the drama of the, you know, you start hearing the countdown and some of them came to an end. So that those added a little bit more drama into it. Those were the better matches, and I think that's why overall I think it's been better. But yeah, and there's also been like a couple scary botches too, which is Hanare and I forgot who else. Two wrestlers have already gotten like hardcore dropped on their neck. The Hanare actually had Kevin Kelly on commentary drop an expletive. It was that scary. So there've been a couple, you know, like botch spots like that too.
You should listen to Javier's audio on the G1. Wade, how would we plug that?
pwtorch.com/govip, everybody.
Yeah, so
now
cool. I'm going to get
Javier.
Yeah, so have a good one. Now that I'm getting played out by Eric. Have a good night, guys.
Thanks, Javier.
Have a good one.
Take care. All right, up next, Brian's in Boston. It's a big night in Boston. Brian, welcome. What's on your mind about Dynamite tonight?
How you guys doing tonight?
Good, good. How about you?
I was doing well. I was looking forward to this show a lot, and by the end of it, I was just left disappointed. I mean, I thought this show kind of sucked, to be honest. I mean, it got off to a good start with Jungle Jack Perry. I'm not calling him Jungle Boy anymore. That doesn't fit. But I thought he would beat Hook, but I thought, like, Anna Jay would come in and would cost Hook the match. So, I mean, the way they did it was fine, but I think at some point you got to put her – you got to put those two together, Anna Jay and Jack Perry, not Jack Perry and Hook, obviously. But I was just wondering if you guys thought that was going to happen, or if they're going to put Anna Jay along with them, because I think it would be a really good dynamic, and she could do some of the talking for him, since she is, well, marginally a better talker than he is. But just wondering your guys' thoughts on that.
Well, she's certainly not burning it up in the ring, so I guess you could mine some really obnoxious heel heat in a Sammy Guevara Tay Conti way, right? How they would, when they were baby faces, they would make out on the stage and couldn't figure out why people were booing them. So they had to turn them. But I could see that working on camera. You know, of course, you know the saying in wrestling, if you have a good, healthy relationship, the best way to kill it is to be an on-camera couple, right? Nothing sours relationships in pro wrestling. That may be a 90s and 80s and 90s thing, though. I think Jack Perry had the – I saw someone on Twitter noted that Jack Perry had the wet hair, which is always the sign of a heel, right?
That's funny, yes. Yeah.
Yeah, so, yeah, I'm open to that. Bryant, you must have been very upset tonight because there was only 1 minute of women's wrestling, and from my perspective, they only had that squash match on the show so they didn't get criticized for not having a women's match tonight. No attack or angle by the Outcasts or anything. It was just sort of there, which I know you're into women's wrestling.
I am into women's wrestling, but that wasn't really the part that didn't really upset me that much. The only thing I thought was that, you know, Britt Baker's been kind of drifting in the wind for a little bit, you know, with Jamie Hayter gone. And, you know, she's supposed to be the face of the division, the top star. So, I mean, if you want to bring her in for a squash match, you know, I mean, you're dealing with basically 1 hour for the rest of the talent, since, you know, Blood and Guts going to take up the other hour. I already do that. So, I mean... if they want to put her in a squash match to get her a win or something, that's fine. But, you know, why couldn't they have had, like, someone come out afterwards or something, like maybe one of the Outcasts or something, just to kind of, you know, kind of light the fire for a little bit of a storyline? I thought they should have, I don't know, just done something after that match instead of just, you know, going to the next thing. But the if I never see Alex Marvez on TV again, it'll be too soon. It's like every time I get the guy's a good sports writer, and that's what he should be doing. He should not be on camera. He's effing awful. I mean, oh yeah, we're going to spy on some guy in a restaurant going by the doorway where they can see you, dumb idiot. He's very cringeworthy. He mm-hmm. shouldn't be doing those kinds of segments. Just have a customary, just have like one of the other, like Lexi Nair or something, like have her like ask for an interview or something when they're walking away from the limousine or something. You don't need to like go all TMZ and stalk them or something. I mean, that his things are just cringeworthy. But the thing that irritated me the most about this show is that the show opened pretty well with Jack Perry and Hook. I wish they'd done the ending a little bit similar. But the thing that really irritated me the most was the dance-off in the tag match. I was really looking forward to that tag match because I thought it'd be pretty good. And the dance-off, the segment before, like, I liked the previous segments that the comedy sort of skits they did with MJF and Adam Cole. I thought they were pretty good and clever, but this one with the Chinese restaurant, it was just lame. It was lame and stupid. I mean, you're assaulting a guy who's just trying to do his job and, like, eating spicy food. It wasn't funny. It wasn't creative. It was dumb. And it kind of soured me on the whole storyline. Then the dance off, that was horrible. I mean, I know MJF like has his own tendencies, and it was probably his idea to begin with. Kind of like the dinner debonair thing was his idea to begin with, which was stupid. But you can't, as a world champion, you're supposed to be. You wouldn't see Roman Reigns doing that kind of shit. I mean, I don't even watch WWE, but your world champion, MJF, he unfortunately, Tony Khan lets him get away with things he shouldn't be getting away with, Dan Debonair, for example. But your world champion should not be doing a freaking dance-off when you're in a match with a tag team title shot on the line. It undermines the credibility of all four guys in the ring when you do that kind of stupid shit. And it just took me out of the match, and I just fast-forwarded to the end. And like my morale was really sinking with the show, but then FTR came out, and I was like, oh, thank God, because those are two guys who were actually take wrestling somewhat seriously. And I was glad to see the stare down there. I was just wondering what your guys' thoughts were on the whole dance-off thing.
Well, Eric, I would say based on feedback and just sort of common sense, it is something where even if some people like it, are amused by it, get a kick out of it, compartmentalize it, there is a big enough downside where I think they should, reevaluate whether that's the right thing to do. And they might feel strongly. This might be a very, a philosophical decision. They, maybe Tony Khan privately, even though he boasts about this, that, and the other thing about data points and metrics, he might be thinking, well, how do we get to the next level? How do we get to the next level? And he might be thinking, we got to do more of this stuff. And he hopes that, the loyal fans will stick around because he delivers blood and guts and 58-minute classic tag matches, but, also wants to try to pull in the person who's only half paying attention in the other room on their phone and going, oh, what's this? This is fun. I want to watch this with you from now on, which, of course, was, the little bit of everything, a little bit of something for everybody philosophy that TNA had for years. And, AEW has a better, a better foundation to build on. Anything you want to add to what we said earlier on that, Eric?
No, I mean, I think it's an attempt to get some YouTube views, and it was Shark Week. They were promoting Shark Week throughout the show in a corporate synergy with Warner Brothers Discovery, the people who signed their TV rights checks. I bet the big shark in the Meg 2 movie that's coming out doesn't chew as much scenery in that movie as MJF does throughout this Cole angle. It's it's pretty up there. Let's not overlook the Alex Marvez comment that Brian made. I have never been able to tell if Wade is doing a bit when Alex Marvez criticism comes up or if it's legit, and I don't know the backstory. But I would note this. I do know this. Wade sure as heck included Chris Jericho calling Marvez a fat-headed idiot in his recap. He did not miss that one in the Russia thing.
Well, there's nothing to read into it. I got nothing against Alex. It's a trivia. Do you know what the name of his newsletter was back in the late 1980s?
I can't remember. I'm sorry.
I suck at acting. Was that a call?
No, come on now. Don't stop pile on. His newsletter was Three Counts, and he was at an internship at the New York Times. He was a Miami Herald reporter, did some really good serious writing on wrestling at a time when there was very little of that in the mainstream. He's a smart guy and went on to, you know, have a successful career outside of pro wrestling. But I don't know what you think is a bit. I mean, I'm just calling it as I see it, and I'm quoting snide comments by wrestlers constantly about everybody. But yeah, I mean, this is his I'm excited because I got a scoop and sources tell me this. I mean, I think they put him in a no-win situation a lot, and it almost feels like they're putting him in situations. And I hate to speculate on this because it speculates that there's mean-spiritedness, and I honestly don't see a lot of that in AEW or much of that. But it says something when I think, are they putting him in a position to make him look bad? And I don't know that that's the case, but it's not great what they have him do and how wrestlers talk about him, but I think they think he's like, 20-year later Kevin Kelly, you know, have the heels – or have wrestlers, not heels, just wrestlers kind of poke fun at him because he's, you know, someone you can poke fun at. It's not so much mean-spirited as maybe playful in a way that feels like there is maybe a little snickering, but I don't know. I mean, it's not – what they have him do isn't great, and what he does isn't his – bailiwick. So I don't know what else to say on it other than continue to observe that that's the case.
I'm old enough to remember when he had a tryout as the play-by-play guy for AEW.
That didn't go well.
I mean, my dog or myself could do a better job acting than he could, but anyway.
I agree. Acting is not a thing. Brian, anything else quick? Because I think we got Mike McMahon here, and I want to get to him before it gets too late.
Oh, I will love to hear his thoughts on it. But I'll be quick about it. The Blood and Guts match, it was okay, but I actually agree with your score. 3.25 or something like that. I would rate it along those lines because it wasn't nearly as good as the prior two Blood and Guts matches. Just there were way too many parts that seemed contrived, like the constant spots with the Young Bucks going off the top rope, the stereo assaults and things like that, and the bed and nails was too much. I mean, you don't need that shit. So, not a bad match, but it could have been a lot better than it was. And I'll just close off by saying that there's a world of difference between Dynamite and Collision. Last week's Collision was like pitch perfect, 10 out of 10. This show sucked. It left me almost regretting having watched it. So I'll hang up and thanks for taking the call, guys.
Thanks, Brent. Eric, is Tony Khan trying to tank Dynamite to make Collision look better by comparison by making Collision the what did you call yourself? A Collisionite or Collision?
A Collider. That's the
Collider. Collider, yeah.
No, I guess I was, even though I had some quibbles with the main event not living up to my unrealistic, lofty expectations and my disappointment that Kota Ibushi is no longer a god and just merely mortal, I did like this Dynamite show a lot. And, even if I didn't agree with, even if I don't like the central world title program that they're doing, It still was an effective Dynamite at doing what AEW does so on Dynamite. So
all right, cool. All right, actually, Mike is message. He's just a couple minutes away from his car, so we'll be hearing from him in a minute. But we'll go to 978 next instead. 978, go ahead, state your name and where you're calling from.
This is Mike, actually. Hey guys, how you doing?
Oh, hey Mike. What number did you say you were calling from? This is a different number, I think.
Is it?
Oh, no. You know what?
You know
what's funny is you did. You gave me the right number. I'm looking at the number I sent you to call as opposed to the number you're calling from. So good to talk to you, Mike. Sorry about that. Now I understand.
All right. No worries.
Yeah, so talk to us. We've been talking for an hour and 40 minutes about this already, but I'm very good to hear your thoughts from inside the building.
Yeah, so I guess I'll start with the main event. I heard you guys just briefly talk about it as I was on hold there. I kind of had the same feelings that I didn't like it as much as the other ones and the other Blood and Guts matches. And I don't know if it's lofty expectations. It probably was, right, because some of these matches have just been completely insane. The one thing I would say about it, you know, some of the spots were definitely over with the live crowd. I mean, the live crowd ate up pretty much anything they did the entire night. But there was some confusion on the finish, and I think it fell a little flat in the building. You've got the submission finish to a cage match where it's not the easiest to see through the fencing, right? There is on the big spots, it's easy to see a guy getting slammed into a bed of nails, for instance. But when you are trying to watch a guy in a hole, or was he getting choked with a chain? Like, I'm even having trouble figuring out what the finish was. Was there a chain involved, or was it just a choke hold? Like, I really couldn't tell through the fencing, and we had seats that were down pretty close. And part of that was because they also weren't airing the match on any of the screens anywhere. There were times during the main event where it was up on the screen. At certain points during the main event, the match was up on the screen, but for large portions of the night, the screen was just the logo of the show. And I think because of the cage, the main scoreboard was pulled all the way up into the ceiling. So there was no, you couldn't look up top and see the screens. So it was hard to tell in this type of match when you're sitting in the crowd, like looking through the fence. I don't think anybody was expecting that to be the finish. And then on top of that, it was kind of hard to see, to make it out. And it didn't feel like it got the type of reaction a 1-2-3 would have gotten.
Yeah, well, it's War Games, and that predating when submissions were in vogue and brought back in vogue by, I don't know if it was Kurt Angle or Taz or what, but you can only win by submission in the match beyond. So, you know, it is interesting, like, because submissions are more common now than when that was invented. It was meant to be, oh, it's not going to be a pinfall, a DQ, or a countout. Someone's going to actually give up. And that was a novelty. You're kind of right. It might not work as well when that isn't a novelty. And then you don't have kind of that dramatic, 1-2-3 or, you know, whatever. And there's so much going on, you don't know where to focus. So it's interesting that, like, you got good seats and you're not quite sure, you know, like, what happened. And I think that, I mean, there were aspects of the match that were flawed. I enjoyed the match, but it was, you know, disjointed here. That was cool. That didn't look good. That didn't work. And I was watching it. It didn't even come close to like 4-star territory for me, but the finish, I think, is what kind of just made me think, like, as I was watching, I'm like, okay, but there's going to be something at the end here. And it didn't really happen. It was a clever finish, you know, Moxie throwing in the towel to help his buddy Yuta, but that's sort of a babyface thing to do when heels are beating up on a guy. But in this case, you know, I mean, I think it was Javier who said, you know, well, the heels, you know, self-destructed and it led to their demise. And so there's some justice in that, but I don't know if that, I mean, I just don't know that that worked. And from what you're saying, it didn't for you, from your perspective in the building.
I mean, even
you know,
the announcers
didn't
know. The announcers had to explain to the crowd after a couple, like 30 seconds after the finish, that Moxley had, submitted on Wheeler's behalf to save him. So in the building, they didn't know, and even the announcers didn't know.
Until you brought that up, I had no idea that that's what happened. I assumed that the Wheeler.
No.
You know, because he was the one in the hole. So I had assumed that he had given up. And I agree, too. Like, I think it's part of the makeup of the match. And it definitely felt like the people in the building were waiting for the big spot that would lead to the ending rather than the ending just being a finish.
Yeah, I was.
You know what I mean? That's kind of what it felt like. So when it happened, and again, without the dramatic 1-2-3, all of a sudden the bell rang and most of the people I were around were kind of like, whoa, what happened? What happened? What happened? And, you know, we're not seeing a replay. We're not, and without obviously the announcers in your ear to let you know what was going on, it felt like there was a little bit of confusion. People were happy that the Elite won, but it felt like that there was a little bit of confusion when the actual finish came.
Yeah.
Mike, did the psychology work for you with two of the heels leaving, given the baby faces a big advantage?
Yeah, I thought that was strange. And you know what? I was actually talking to somebody around me at the time. I said it almost felt like that was setting up maybe for someone else to come in, which I think may have led to some of the confusion around the finish, because there was definitely kind of a sense from the people I was around. You could hear just conversations. People were like, all right, well, this is going to lead to someone else coming out, right? Is there a return? Is someone debuting? Mm. What's going to happen? And I think it kind of led people down a path of expecting something different, because it is weird, you know, when you've got the baby faces that all of a sudden have the big advantage. It's not usually how the psychology of that type of match would work, right? I mean, it's always the heels are always the ones with the man advantage when it comes to the entrances, because it just doesn't work the other way. And then at the finish of the match, the baby faces were, and it had a two-man advantage right there at the end.
How over did Hook seem, and did you think Jack Perry worked as a heel? Was the match big enough to fill an arena that size? It worked for me on television.
It worked for me too. Yeah, and it's funny because I wouldn't have thought that it would have. Like if somebody laid out to me on paper the plan of we're going to turn Jack Perry heel, we're going to completely change his music, and we're going to air this video package before he comes out, I would have said there's no way that that's going to work. But it did. I thought it worked really, really well. And I don't know if it was just because it was the opener and people were excited to cheer something. But, yeah, no, Hook got a very big reaction. I'm sure part of that is he's the first babyface to, you know, make his ring entrance for the night. And that, I'm sure, had a big played a big role. But, yeah, no, he was over really well. He got a big reaction. And I thought that people bought into Jack Perry's heel turn. And I thought he did a good job of presenting himself as a heel, considering, you know, Andrew and I have talked about it on our show for a month now. Like, we just didn't think it would work. We really didn't. Night one, it worked pretty well.
Yeah, cool. MJF Cole stuff, the dance-off, Garcia, Guevara, just what are we going to – give us a preview of what you and Andrew will be doing, talking about and how you'll frame this on Monday.
So we both crapped on this pretty hard on Monday when we recorded last week, or this past week, 2 days ago. I will say this, having been in the building and really being able to absorb the way that the crowd reacted to it, if I'm Tony Khan and I'm sitting in the building every week and I hear that type of reaction for what those two guys are doing, I think you got to go for it, because it was nearly unanimous. People were really, really into both guys and just the act they were doing. Even the video package was getting a big reaction when they were at the Kowloon, the Chinese restaurant, the night before or whatever that was taped. But, you know, that was getting a big reaction. And then when they were in front of the crowd, even a bigger reaction. So I personally didn't like it when I was watching the way it was presented on TV the last couple of weeks. But you know what? Having seen the reaction and heard the reaction that they got tonight, if I'm Tony, I think that I would – I understand why he went in this direction and why he continued to go in this direction. And even though they teased a little bit of MJF, you know, trending back towards being a heel right at the end of the match or in the post-match, actually,
yeah.
It kind of feels like this is something they may want to ride for a while, because it got one of the biggest reactions of the night.
I actually think that's worth mentioning. I keep thinking of mentioning it and then never get around to it. When Cole picked up the belt and admired it, and then MJF saw him looking at it and longing for it, and he snatched it away. It's like, mine. I mean, you know, when my mom brings her dog over and her dog plays with my dog's toys, my dog really gets possessive of those toys. And he'll ignore them, you know, for days. And, oh, but that's my toy. You don't get to have that. And that's what, you know, it was very like, that's mine. You don't admire it. And Cole's like, oh, well, I was going to, you know, hand it over to you. But then, and MJF's like, oh, fine. And then Cole turns around and the camera catches MJF. He can't help himself, you know, kind of turn into a snarl. And I thought that was like a window. It was just played right, because everything else is sort of zany and over the top. But that was, I mean, it's pro wrestling. It's hitting over the head with a hammer in any other context. But there, he didn't overdo it. It was just Adam Cole turns around. He's like, he wants my title. And so it plays up the idea that MJF is taking advantage of this random draw, assuming it is random. Maybe it has manipulated the – I don't know. But they're not going to do that. He took advantage of the random draw to try to befriend and take a contender he's nervous about out of the mix by making it seem like it would be a betrayal of their friendship for Cole to challenge MJF for the title, because MJF fears Cole might have his number. And that moment revealed it. And so, you know, we say there's all this, you know, they're going for comedy and viral moments, but that moment was like maybe the high point of the show in terms of, okay, now we got a window into what's going on here. And I'm, you know, I'm connecting dots and coloring in areas that maybe are too specific, but probably not. Eric, what do you think?
No, I think that's exactly it. Earlier in the show, I laid out how the challenge is, how do you get tonally from comedy shtick that is, you know, easy heat over with the crowd in a big way to the seriousness that you really have to put behind a world title match at All in London in front of 75,000 people, right? And that was at least a nice first step toward that. They still got 5 dynamites and 6 collisions to, you know, to get there. So no shortage of TV time to fill before then. So you might see, I guess, did they announce tonight when the tag title match is going to take place? And if it's
July 29th on Collision.
Really? Okay. So in 10 days. Yep. Okay. So presumably that'll be a big, weird to have it on Collision after you had the whole tournament on Dynamite, but okay. Got to prop up Collision's ratings. Should be interesting to see how that'll be a chance for another big step in the angle toward building for the All-In show in London.
Mike, anything else from Dynamite you want to share? And then we'll give people a fair warning. You can tell us anything about Rampage and things that happen off camera.
I was really impressed with the size of the crowd. So they had the building. I don't know what WrestleTix's final numbers were, but it was in the neighborhood of 10,000. Yeah, and I think they had it set up for about 10. So it was, there was less than a thousand tickets, excuse me, available as of like 2 o'clock this afternoon, and they had opened up some sections. I think 2 days ago. I think it was a Sunday. They opened up some more balcony sections. So I actually wasn't sure how many sections in the lower bowl were open. Only because even in the secondary market, like I checked on StubHub and everything else, there was almost nothing that you could get in the lower sections. Ticketmaster had zero seats available in the lower section, the lower bowl, including resale, and StubHub and SeatGeek had very few available in the lower bowl. So, and not many on the hard cam side. So I said, oh, you know what? I wonder if you know, the basically the whole hard cam side was not opened up. It was hard to tell. But no, we got there tonight, and we actually was lucky enough to grab tickets very late this afternoon. I went into it going, hey, I can get balcony tickets, you know, whenever I want. There's more of those available, but I'm just going to kind of keep refreshing and hoping that some tickets in the lower bowl open up. And later on this afternoon, they did. So I was able to grab a couple kind of last minute. And when I got there and looked around, I was like, wow, the entire lower bowl is full. And, you know, most of the middle balcony sections were all full, and the top half of the sections kind of behind the net, for example, if you're at a hockey game, those were maybe three quarters of the way full. And Tony Khan it acknowledged that when he came out before the show and after the show. He cut two promos, one before and one after. He talked about how he actually got his business start in Boston. The sports analytics company that he owns is based out of Boston. And how it's always, you know, of course he's putting over, he's treating it like a baby face, as he should. You know, he was putting it over as one of his favorite towns to go to. He was excited to be in that building for the first time because they had always run a Gannis Arena, which is at Boston University, before this. That building is probably, for wrestling, between 5,000 and 6,000. So they legitimately almost doubled their crowd size tonight, I would think. And he kind of alluded to the fact that, hey, the next time we come back, I'm acknowledging that we did a really good gate tonight, and there was a lot of people here. He didn't say it directly, but did kind of hint and tease that they may be looking at Boston and TD Garden for a pay-per-view down the road.
How was his demeanor? How was the crowd reaction for him? You know, just Tony's an interest, you know, an interesting, brings an interesting energy when he makes public appearances, and sometimes people are like, oh, interesting. Well, how was he?
He was very excited.
Yeah.
No, but, and that's kind of what you expect, I think. You know, having seen enough of these now, and just the way that he will cut those promos and kind of carry himself publicly, he was very excited. And the thing with him is like, I'll joke about it every once in a while, but I don't think that it's not genuine. Like, I think that's just his personality.
Oh, right.
I think that's who he is.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, I think he's just an excited guy. And, you know, sometimes this isn't always the best, as we've discussed, but it does come across like, okay, this guy owns a multi-million dollar wrestling company. He's got 3 shows on cable TV every week. But he's also just like a big fan. Like, that genuineness comes across when he cuts those types of promos and he's talking to the crowd. That energy is there. So the people went nuts when he came out at the beginning of the show, before they went on the air for Dynamite. He came out between Dynamite and Rampage, I think, to try to fill some time because it was taking them a very long time to get the rings turned over and everything else before the tapings for Rampage started. So at one point he came out and thanked everybody for being there and kind of plugged what they were going to have on Rampage, I think, in an effort to just try to kind of keep people around, because there was a good, probably 30 minutes between when Dynamite ended and when the Rampage tapings began. Because,
it
was a long time. Because they were changing the canvases, and then they were changing the ropes, and they were changing the turnbuckle pads, and they were changing – They had to get the cage raised up, and they had to get all the platforms in place for the cage, for the cameramen out of the way. Like, it was a pretty long time between Dynamite ending and Rampage beginning. So I think part of the second one may have just been, let's try to keep people here and make sure people don't leave. But it was, he came out and actually cut a second promo there as well.
So talk about Rampage. Spoiler alert for anyone who wants to be surprised on Friday. But, they had some the Rumble match, right, their version?
Yes. So it's interesting is I didn't see anything announced or written about this. I assume Friday's Rampage is only 1 hour, right? It's not like a 2-hour special or anything like that?
Yep. Yeah.
Okay. Because the Rumble match was about 40 minutes, roughly speaking, about 40 minutes. Then the 6-man with the Acclaimed and QTV was about another 20. And they still had the announced TBS championship match between Chris Statlander and Mia Shafir after that. And I wasn't sure if that match was going to happen. Once they went from right to the Rumble match to the 6-man, I said, okay, I wonder if they're going to have to scrap the women's title match, because I don't see how there's going to be enough time on the show unless they heavily edit the Rumble, and I guess you could do that with commercial breaks that don't have picture-in-picture. You just cut out a bunch of time. But it was it felt like they were way over on time, because we actually didn't even see the TBS championship match. We ended up leaving just to kind of avoid some traffic and try to get out of the building. It was also 4 hours that I'd been sitting in the very uncomfortable TD Garden seats. But the Rumble was good. I mean, the Royal Rampage Rumble, whatever they
call it. I think that's what they call it. The Rampage Rumble, the Royal Rampage, something like that,
Something like that. It was good. Yeah. I mean, they started with 4 guys in the ring, just like everything else. It kind of felt like there were times where there was 90 seconds between ring entrances, and other times there was like 30 seconds between the ring entrances. But they started with 4, and I think that's why it took so long. It wasn't like a 20 guys in the ring all at once and the bell rings and it's a battle royal. 4 guys start, and I think what they were going for was every minute somebody else came, the next person came to the ring. So it was a Royal Rumble, from that perspective. And then after that, they went right into the 6-man pretty quickly. And then, the Acclaim, obviously, they've got their title match on Saturday. So, spoiler alert, they won the 6-man. The Rumble was won by Darby Allin. I could be wrong. I think Darby Allin and Swerve Strickland were the first two entrants, and they were the last two standing. And Darby ended up getting the win after taking a pretty gross-looking powerbomb from the top. Swerve had Darby Allin on the top rope, took him off and powerbombed him on top of his skateboard, but like flipped upside down. So
oh. Oh, God.
Yeah, yeah, I don't know how you take that and not have it hurt. You know?
Yeah.
Because, I mean, look, landing on it flat, maybe, but, you know, upside down with the wheel turned up, that's, you're going to feel that no matter how much you arch your back. So he took that power bomb, but still ended up getting the win there. And then in the title match, not sure who won that because we were on our way to the car.
Yeah.
I can tell you Chris Statlander retained her title.
Well, that was the expectation.
No shock.
But so it doesn't seem like we missed anything there.
Yeah.
Was the Royal Rampage kind of a mid-card battle royal, basically?
Yeah, for the most part. I mean, Darby Allin was the highlight, I mean, for sure, in terms of entrances. There was a couple of surprises. Minoru Suzuki was in the match, which got a pretty big reaction. He was up pretty early. So that received a pretty big reaction. There was a couple. Nick Wayne was in the match. You know, he was in the match for a pretty long time, too. I think he was one of the ones who started probably third or fourth and was around until probably the final four, roughly speaking, if I'm guessing. But it was definitely – there was a lot of spots in there that definitely highlighted Darby Allin, and he seemed to really be the focus. Him and Swerve were kind of the focus, with Nick Wayne, you know, getting a lot of love and a lot of spots in there as well.
Kota Ibushi, talk about the recognition of the 10,000 in there, how intense, how many knew, how many cared, and, you know, just what did you think of what you saw tonight from him?
Yeah, it was interesting. So, being the last entry into the match, I think obviously everybody knew who was coming and people were prepared for it, so you didn't kind of get that big shock when the music hit, but people were definitely knew who he was. You know, if it just came out of nowhere and he was like the third guy in the ring, I think it would have maybe gotten a bigger reaction initially, just because there may have been a little bit of a surprise factor. But no, people definitely knew who he was. He got a very big reaction, a couple of funny spots at the end. After the match, I tweeted this. I don't think it made air, but Kenny Omega cut a promo after the match was over, and Claudio was getting Moxley cut loose from the chain and everything, Omega was putting over the BCC and said he respects them and loves going to battle with them and would do it again if they want to, and would they shake his hand, and they kind of, you know, Omega stuck out his hand in Moxley, and then Claudio and then Wheeler all shook hands with Kenny and then the rest of the Elite, and they left the ring. And but it was a funny Kota Ibushi spot after that promo. Ibushi just kind of standing there. Oh, I'm sorry. As part of that, Omega, you know, he knows a couple of different things. He knows that anywhere the Elite goes, he will go, and he's never going to abandon the Elite. He also said he knows that this is not going to be Ibushi's last time in an AEW ring, which generated a very big reaction. So we don't know when or where, obviously, but it seems like he will be back at some point. And then the funny part of that was as Omega said that, Ibushi took a voluntary self-bump into the thumbtacks, which got a funny reaction from the crowd. He just kind of stood there and just dropped himself right into the tacks and got up and started yelling. And I think people appreciated that. It was kind of funny.
Any noteworthy fan chants? I keep saying fun instead of fan. That stood out. Maybe some that didn't pick up momentum, others that did.
There was one, man, it tells you just like kind of the environment that you get, especially I think on a night like this with that type of match. There was a "We Want Fire" chant at one point.
we picked up on that one after the "We Want." They got the tables they wanted, so they're like, all right, they're taking requests.
Yeah, exactly. Which was, you know, at some point, but I think, come on, I don't want somebody to burn on live TV. I'm okay without fire. Fire's a little too unpredictable for me. As much as a bed of nails is not very predictable either, but, you know, fire is very unpredictable. That was one. Other than that, I mean, nothing that wasn't your typical fight forever, this is awesome, all that type of stuff. Actually, the one thing that did surprise me was not a lot of reaction positively or negatively towards Punk at all. I mean, he wasn't mentioned, right? But there was no, like, there were no punk signs. There were also no anti-punk signs.
Interesting.
Yeah. When they showed highlights, I think it was before the Blood and Guts match, they showed highlights of Collision on Saturday on the screen. I assume that also aired on TV. And even when Punk was on the screen, I mean, there was a smattering of applause, but there really wasn't a big positive reaction or a big negative reaction. People just kind of ignored it, which was surprising. I was kind of expecting, because it was a very pro-elite crowd. So I was kind of expecting any reference or image of Punk may get a negative reaction, but it wasn't there. It felt like people were indifferent more than anything else.
Eric, anything else you want to ask Mike about his experience?
I do not have anything other questions for Mike.
Mike, anything else you want to add? Otherwise, you can plug your show and people can hear more from you come Monday.
Yeah, I think that's it. Overall, it was a good night. You know, I took my son with me, who's never been to an AEW show before, but has been to plenty of WWE shows, and said, you know, I asked him.
Oh, does he? What do you think?
I'm sorry?
How old is he, and what did he think? I think I stepped on you as you were getting to that.
Oh, sorry. No, he is 13, and as we were walking back to the car, I said, hey, you know, how would you compare this to other shows you've been to? What did you like it more? Did you like it less? And he liked it a lot more and said that, you know, he liked the fact that the crowd was a little bit different. It was a little more interactive, I think, and he seemed to like it a lot more. The live experience, like any kid his age, that, you know, they don't tend to sit in front of the TV and watch not just AEW or wrestling. They don't really watch anything. they kind of live on YouTube and TikTok and everything else. It's like short 20-second bursts, not a full two-hour episode. But the live, like, he was excited to go because it's the live experience. He does enjoy that. So he seemed to like it more than other shows he's been to in the past, which I found interesting. I did kind of prepare him as we were walking into the building. I said, hey, just so you know, this will be a different crowd than you've been around before. It's going to be a little bit older. You know, it might be a little bit louder. But he seemed to like the chance, and he seemed to like the energy, and definitely said it was different than other shows he's been to before, but I think he liked it in a positive way.
Cool. Well, Mike, talk about your show.
Oh, yeah. Andrew and I record, we still call it the All Elite After Show, even though we're not after AEW anymore. But we've changed the name like three times. We're not going to change it again. We record on Mondays on the Daily Cast blog talk feed. So you can listen live. You can also call. We've been taking calls again for the last couple of months, which has been a lot of fun. We record on Mondays, and then I think most people will find it in their podcast feed Tuesday morning, right?
Yes. Yep.
So there you go. Yeah, and I'm sure we'll be talking about this next week.
Excellent. Well, thank you, Mike. I know it's been a long night, and I really appreciate you calling us up and giving us your perspective on this.
Absolutely. Thanks, guys. Good to talk to you.
Absolutely. Very good. So, Eric, we got a few emails I want to get to, but we're running long. So do you have time to stick around for emails? And I'm thinking of making it a VIP extra, an after show for our VIP members.
Sure.
Okay. So we'll do a sign-up here on the free show. Go VIP. When we run long, sometimes we just turn in the VIP after show so the, you know, download size isn't too long with everything on the free side of things too. So go VIP, pwtorch.com/goVIP. Join me Friday night after SmackDown and Saturday after Collision. And we welcome those of you who download the show after the fact to be a live caller and be part of the show, or just email, even if you can't listen live. Eric, thanks a lot, and we'll just talk to you on the other side of the music for VIP members.
Thank you.
All right, so up first in the VIP exclusive after show mailbag is Al from New York City. And he says, did AEW just turn Jungle Boy because of Dom Mysterio's success? Eric, how much of Dominic have you seen?
Enough to know he gets molten heat in the arena there, and then they put the belt on him on NXT last night, and he's doing a cowardly heel gimmick hiding behind Rhea Ripley. Does that about sum it up?
Fair enough, yep.
Still not a good worker? Yeah, okay, got it.
Yeah, yep. And I don't – no, I think – I think they turned Jungle Boy. Independent of Dom, I think they're very different different people, Al. Then he says, the Young Bucks don't feel like big deals anymore, and neither does Chris Jericho. They're just one-trick ponies, superkick party. Wheeler Yuta seems like a bad choice for BCC, and Danny Garcia would have been a better choice. I'm not sure I disagree that Garcia might have been a better choice, but I don't think Wheeler is a bad choice. I mean, you can tell there's just massive respect by Danielson, Moxley, and Claudio for what Yuta brings in terms of his intensity and his toughness, and there's just a sinewy, like, badass aspect to his style, even if his personality, it makes him number four out of four when, you know, you talk about that group. So I don't have a problem with either of you being in the group. I just sort of have a problem with the whole way the Blackpool Combat Club are cast. So that's my comment on that. Yeah, the Bucks do not feel like big deals anymore. And it's weird because I don't think Tony Khan's even trying to make them seem like big deals. And I don't think he's been marketing them for years. They're just kind of along for the ride, have a good match now and then. Eric, is that does that seem outlandish to frame it that way?
I think you're a little more down on the Bucks than I am. They always deliver. I mean, I think the thing about the Young Bucks is you can heat them up at any time you want, right? I would agree they've been sort of under-pushed relative probably to their paychecks pretty much since, I mean, for all, you know, the all-out thing led to a couple of months suspension, the brawl out last year, and then they were in a six-man, right? They were in a best-of-seven six-man series. So it's, to me, they completed their storyline with the reunification of Hangman Page, so I'm happy with the Bucks. Maybe they haven't felt like the sort of company, defining megastars that you might have thought when AEW started, right? And they were having ladder matches with the Lucha Brothers on pay-per-views. So, but, you know, still can be heated up and reignited at the top of the card. And the elite Blackpool Combat Club has probably been, for me, the best angle on TV all year. So I guess I'm a little higher on them than Al from New York or you.
Well, but in terms of, like, marketing them, that's the issue. It's not that they aren't – you can't – they have a body of work that you can enjoy, but it just – it doesn't feel like they're framed or given a boost by Tony Khan. They're just sort of like, here's a match where you guys can be – have a good match. But, you know, the character development, the building the brand around them, treating them as, you know, a centerpiece act, it just doesn't – I don't sense Tony Khan brings any kind of – tries to – shine a spotlight on them beyond sort of, yeah, just go have your good matches.
I mean, Tony Khan not putting a spotlight, I mean, you could say that of, you know, 60 to 70% of the roster, right? That's the chronic complaint.
Well, right, but
Talent
are not co-founders.
Totally assign 100% of the blame to Tony Khan. How much of it is the Bucks' fault, right?
Well, for sure. I think that's part of it, yeah. I mean, the fact that the Bucks and Cody are chatting, you know, according to Cody in a Fightful interview, chatting regularly and stuff. And I don't know, you know, who, just the chemistry there with those two. There's someday we'll find out if there's just like a 3.5 year, like passive aggressive tension between them, even though Tony visits them in their locker room and, you know, it's like, it's not like it's a bad relationship, but I think it's speculative, but informed speculation that it just sort of feels like Tony's excitement lies elsewhere and the Bucks are sort of okay with that. They're making good money. But it doesn't feel like they just show up to work going, you know, how can we help Tony make this company bigger? Or Tony shows up going, I want to get the most out of the Bucks I can and create a whole new layer of fans for the Bucks. Like you said, maybe that's just kind of Tony's way and the Bucks have kind of resigned themselves to it. And they're fine at this stage of their careers with the mileage to do what they're doing, you know, and that booking and character work isn't their favorite thing.
If you believe what's been written about the return of CM Punk vis-a-vis the Young Bucks, Punk's on Collision because the Bucks don't want to be in the same locker room as him, right?
All right.
So
yep.
I can't imagine they're super enthusiastic about giving 150% instead of 100%, right, given that they feel they were hard done by Punk last year, both on camera and in the brawl afterward. Now, I don't want to relitigate that, but maybe if you didn't take Punk up on his offer to go to his locker room, none of that would have happened, right? So
exactly, yeah. All right, Zach in Texas. Gentlemen, my body hurts after watching a blood and guts match. That was brutal, but as a Southerner, WCW is in my blood. I love War Games, and I love when War Games is violent and bloody, just as God intended. Still, you couldn't pay me to take a spot on a bed of nails. I appreciate the cleverness of BCC's hodgepodge bad guys partnerships with Pac and Don Callis coming back to bite them in the end. I also love that we didn't get a hokey spot off the top of the cage. As for the rest of the show, Jack Perry's settling nicely into being a heel. I agree with that. There's nothing that says pretentious more than coming out to classical music. Hook looked great. I look forward to their eventual hair versus hair match. Wade, I hope you checked on Todd Martin after the MJF Cole stuff, because I fear he may have had a stroke or with a blood vessel bursting when they went into the dance-off. I was entertained in spite of myself. We were with you there. And no doubt the crowd loved them. True. They popped for a well-built double clothesline spot, for goodness sake. Still, MJF's turn has to be brutal enough to make this all worth it. He's certainly going to get heat for breaking up the partnership. I'm really interested to see how they pull this off. Oh, and Kota Ibushi's in AEW. I need the Golden Lovers versus FTR ASAP. Eric, your thoughts?
Well, I certainly would pay $50 to see Golden Lovers versus FTR on a pay-per-view. And, you know, from the sound of it, a potential new TV deal may have as many as 12 AEW pay-per-views. I think that feels like a bit much to me, but 8 would be good. You know, more AEW pay-per-views would provide more focus to the booking, and they wouldn't have to stretch stuff out because they only have, you know, 5 shows a year. Really 4, because the one is with New Japan, and that's sort of like a, you know, outside the lines of the normal storylines for the most part. Zach brought up the bed of nails spot, and I am not a deathmatch fan. Like, it's not my thing, never has been. I've always intrigued when I, you know, ever dip my toe into seeing a little GCW or whatever. It again, reinforces not my thing. But I'm like, I think the nails have to be gimmicked, right? Because if they're not, yeah, you're impaled and you're dead. So how do you know how they gimmick the bed of nails so that you're not falling through it and dying?
Yeah, they dull the points and they have them dense enough that, you know, that it's spread out enough not to puncture you. I mean, if they took away half the nails, I think you'd be impaled. But, you know, with enough nails and the right kind of landing. But I that's just me observing and guessing.
Okay.
Yeah. All right. And then JB in Detroit. Hey, team, it'd be funny if the gold that Jungle Boy predicted he would win in 2023 was the FTW title. What are the chances that JB wins a bigger title sometime before years? And I don't know. There's no rush for him to win another title. There's, you know, a number of them to go around, but international or TNT could happen, but it doesn't have to happen. I just think it's weird that AEW is sanctioning and advertising a title that isn't a title. It's not recognized by them. I mean, so it's fine if you want to put it up for grabs, but it should be like, you know, putting up for grabs your favorite pair of tennis shoes or something. It's not something that you get a graphic and a formal ring introduction. And I don't say that to demean the title. I think it differentiates it. It's a personal prop between, you know, it's a personal prop that means something. And so you can have a match for it, but don't actually seem to sanction it.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I think we're long past the point in AEW and even New Japan Wrestling, which also has the problem of a lot of titles or too many titles. They are just props, you know, they're plot devices. The belts are plot devices meant to add intrigue and stakes to a match, instead of it just being old. You know, it's not enough to be just a good old-fashioned, I'm gonna fight you, and I'm going to beat you, and I'm going to win, and I'm going to move up the rankings, or I'm going to move up the pecking order. The thinking, I assume, is title matches equals fan interest, but since that's not working all that well for AEW, I'm not sure how effective it is.
Yeah. Number two, I've actually enjoyed much of the comedic aspect of the MJF Cole blind take storyline, but even I think the dance-off in the final match might have been a step too far. How could anyone have been ready in the back to play dance-off music? Well, what do you think, Eric, and them having or MJF going over and hitting a button as if there's like this button you can push to play any kind of genre of music?
I mean, it was sort of the equivalent of when they have the flimsiest of excuses to have a Renee or Alex Marvez backstage peeking into a room, right? And then all of a sudden they're gone and you're seeing what's going on. It's the equivalent of that.
Yeah, there you go. Three. However, what I did enjoy about the match was how good of a job that both MJF and Cole did in getting the crowd to invest in the story and this match in particular. And I did compliment that in my written report at pwtorch.com covering Dynamite. They have chemistry. And, we're worried about how they come out of this. And, MJF's already done, you know, the song and dance stuff and comedy stuff. And he's come out of it okay, but you can argue he'd be better off if the range of what he did was more focused and narrow. And you know, but whatever. That's subjective, but – it's certainly a thought I'm not the only one expressing. Adam Cole has been a little lost since he arrived in AEW. It felt, you know, for all kinds of reasons. This does seem to be giving him a chance to show a different side of him, I think, than I'm trying to think of other instances where like this came across. And again, I don't know if it's good. I don't know if it's not. I don't know if we're going to want to forget it and discard it or build on it, but it is for a Dynamite audience that wasn't watching NXT a lot, they're getting to see more of Adam Cole performing again, kind of more of a wide range than they did before. And I haven't really fully processed how that's going to work for him. How do you think?
I mean, Adam Cole has been a top guy in every promotion he's ever been in, I think, right? He ascends because he carries himself like a top star and is good on the mic. Though those are his strong suits. It certainly, he was probably on top for maybe too long in NXT. Cause you know, I think they were probably reasonably trying to Triple H was trying to protect him from going. Hunter was trying, Paul, sorry, Levesque was trying to protect him from going to the main roster where Vince allegedly saw him as a manager of Keith Lee. Right. So, or whoever. And so, you know, Cole's entry into AEW was a little bit star-crossed in that he was new. They kind of fed him to champion Hangman Page right away. And then he got injured for 9 months or whatever, close to a year. And so who knows what they had planned for him. But, you know, he's performing well in this angle I just haven't liked. But I saw a glimpse tonight of the, you know, as we've said a couple times, you've said when MJF snatched the belt away from him of, you know, this thing will heat back up and veer toward the serious and an actual, you know, world title program will be established. And my hope is that when they do that, that Cole will not be the dumb baby face. Because if he does that, right, just forget it. I'll just watch Collision, you know. I mean, I'll obviously watch Dynamite, but I won't be happy about it.
But is there something you can build on that we've seen from Cole that we didn't know about him or see in AEW from him, you know, in previous months? Or do you discard this and hit reset?
I mean, I don't think you're going to hit reset on him. I don't think he's going to switch his gimmick. It's just, is he a face or a heel, and who is he allied with, and who is he feuding with? You know, I do worry at the end of the day. I mean, maybe. So he lost a world title program, two world title matches with Hangman Page in 2022, and then he's going to lose. I can't imagine they're going to belt him up at All in London. But, you know, then he's going to be sort of a guy who's ascended to the top of the card twice and lost and couldn't win the big one. And what does that lead to? I mean, I guess you pivot from there. He's frustrated. He turns heel again because he couldn't win the big one. You know, I don't know. How much is his on-screen fate tied to Britt Baker's on-screen fate? Like, if she's a heel, is he going to be a heel and vice versa? But, I mean, that is sort of after All In, you know, I'm assuming he doesn't win the title and it's going to be a crossroads for him. And you know, I mean, there are worse things than having an established upper mid-card performer who can hold his own on the mic during a feud.
Up next, I enjoy that Darby and Nick Wayne were too cool to put in their hands with best friends. It gives Darby more credibility and Nick Wayne instant credibility. What do you think about it? We really haven't talked about that. We got, you know, there's not a big sample size of Nick Wayne so far. How did that work aside from kind of the weird Darby asking Cassidy to do Air Fox a favor?
I mean, you know, Nick Wayne is to Darby as Darby was to Sting, right? Sort of the dad figure or the bigger brother, big brother figure, I guess, in the way older brother. I mean, look, you got to fill TV time every week. I don't think they announced, you know, it goes by fast. I don't think they announced anything for next week's Dynamite other than Orange Cassidy and AR Fox, which is not a main event in the country. I thought it was a weird, it all seemed shoehorned in, right? It was a weird way to set up a match next week for Dynamite. Next week. And I guess I it was there to plug Rampage. It was there to set up a match next week on Dynamite in a very weird fashion. Why isn't AR Fox out there asking for the match himself? I don't know.
Yeah.
It's generally you want to win a – you want to be on a win streak, right, too. Or at least I get that you're not going to do a win streak because – if you put AR Fox against some local talent for 3 weeks in a row to set him up for a title match anywhere other than Rampage, the ratings are going to crater, right? So, but even one win, right, would have to establish him would have been and show off his tremendous in-ring skill set. Might have been a better way to go, but they're trying to jam everything in. It's Dynamite.
Speaking of plugs, he said, "I'm a little concerned. The only match they announced for Collision." Is, as of now, is the trios title match between House Black and the acclaimed Billy Gunn. I think it'll be interesting to see ratings with nothing being heavily promoted, including Punk. I'm not rooting for a rapid fire Excalibur, bang, 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 but it feels like not mentioning anything on Collision on Saturday and now just going with that as your hook. I don't know. I'm worried about sustaining that 575-580 range in terms of total viewership.
For sure. This was like one of the last things that I have not said that's in my notebook, which is, boy, they haven't teased much for Collision, and they're going to announce more matches on Rampage, which means if you go by last week's audience, 310,000 people will find out from AEW TV what's on Saturday's Collision, right?
Yep.
That is not a recipe for a good rating.
No.
They got to be disciplined and set up or announce stuff ahead of time, and I get that they got a lot of stuff flying around. It's Tony Khan is in his in the Premier League, British soccer. He's in the transfer window, right? The month of July and August are when you can reload your team with players, and that's a lot of work. And there's a time difference there of 5-6 hours, but I think it was week two of Collision where they didn't. Week one, I was there at the United Center. They had the six-man tag was the main event between Punk and Ricky's eight-man tag. I don't know. Some sort of tag was the main event. Punk and Joe on opposite sides. And boy, they did not set up anything for week two. And then week two dropped by a couple 100,000 viewers. Right. So it's in their best interest to be disciplined. And if Tony Khan is busy, maybe delegate to others who are going to, book some matches.
Did they do enough to tout what happened on Saturday night in that 58-minute match?
I mean, they did not capitalize on the epicness of it, but to me, it's baby steps for AEW. The fact that they even had a Collision recap at all is, when their beloved Dynamite, that some people might flip the channel because it's not live in-ring action for 2 minutes or 1 minute or whatever the recap was, it is progress for them, right?
Yeah. All right. I like how Taz sold being pissed off about Hook's life for the entire show. It made the moment feel bigger, which AEW fails to do much of the time. all right. Six, I think the line of the night was when Mox brought out the bucket of glass from under the ring and Taz said something like, he probably wants to fill it with the Golden Elite's blood and dump it on himself, because that was literally my initial thought as well. I agree with the announced team's assessment that there isn't a match more custom-tailored for Mox. this felt like Moxley's playground. I mean, for better or for worse, it doesn't mean it's going to be everybody's match, but this is his thing.
Yeah, he was clearly the driving creative force behind this. It's the third one of these. Anybody got any idea? You could see them getting together to map out the match, lay it out, and anybody got any ideas? And Mox quickly, eagerly raising his hand, saying, "Yeah, why don't we do deathmatch stuff in there?" The motion carries because nobody else had any other ideas. They did a decent job of the big players in the match all getting their chances to shine, which is sort of baked into the match structure as it is, because every 2 minutes somebody's coming in, and generally that, if it's a face, the face is evening the odds and, getting some good crowd reaction, babyface crowd reaction. And if it's a heel coming in, when they have the advantage, then they're getting heat because they're, beating down the faces. So it's easy. It's sort of tailor-made to just have a moment for everybody to shine. That was true for Hangman. It wasn't so much true for Kota Ibushi until later in the match when all of the Elite were in submission holds, and he independently came around and kicked all five of the Blackpool Combat Club guys to get them to relinquish the hold. So, you know, the match had the all five faces in submissions, check, all a double down times five, check, all 10 men fighting in center ring to kind of set up the closing stretch. Yes. I mean, so, you know, they played the hits, in addition to the unique stuff like the thumbtack ring that they brought to the table. I thought there was going to be a riot when the third split screen break was a full break and to a commercial. I'm like, are you kidding me? Really?
Yeah.
I mean, this is not Rampage, is it? That was kind of crazy. I liked the spot in that main event where Pac, he hit Omega when they went to the submissions. Pac had Omega in the Brutalizer, which he beat Omega with at the first All Out. I mean, I remember that because I was in the building, and I was sitting on the wrong side of the arena, and I didn't understand why the match was over because there was no way Kenny Omega was going to submit. I can't remember what the start of the question was because I'm a little woozy this deep into the night, I must admit.
Yes, for sure. Well, I'm on this.
Everyone knew the finish of that match was Wheeler Yuta submitting, right? I mean, there wasn't a doubt in the...
I mean, everybody knew that would be the easiest call to make in the match, but sometimes they surprise us.
Yeah, my only hedge at some point in the match was I thought, well, Pac's not going to cause Claudio to lose. Does Claudio cause Pac to lose? But then they used that for something else to set up the ROH title match. So, yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Finally, do the walkouts on the BCC lessen the Golden Elite's win, and does this end the BCC Elite feud? Do we move on to the Elite versus the Don Callis family next? And is it possible the BCC dissolves so AW can utilize Mox and eventually Danielson as single stars? A lot packed in there, but what do you think?
Does this end the feud? Yes, I believe so. Does what was the second one?
Oh, there were a lot.
Does the Elite go to feud?
Yeah.
Don Callis family. Yeah, Kenny does. I assume the rest of the Elite does as well, but I guess it depends on who ends up in Don Callis's family. Jericho would seem a lock at this point, given how the fellow members of the Jericho Appreciation Society have treated him the last 2 weeks, right? Danny Garcia and Sammy blew him off when he tried to console them on their way out after losing the tag match. And then Jake Hager gave him his beloved purple hat last week and said he's not down with it. So, I mean, I guess there could be a swerve and it could be Kenny and Jericho versus the Callis family, but you'd still need more members of the Callis family at that point, right? And it's not going to be the Blackpool Combat Club because they walked. You know, Takeshita walked out.
Exactly.
On it, so.
Exactly. Yeah. Cool. Okay. Well, and there it is. Get late. I think, 2.5 hours talking this show. It's plenty. Thank you all our VIP members for listening. Thanks to emails for giving us a few different topics to cover. Taz being pissed off the whole show. I mean, isn't Taz just often pissed off the whole show? Actually, that's old Taz. New Taz is pretty gregarious and jolly. Eric, thanks. It's been a lot of fun.
Thank you for having me. It has been fun, and I'm glad we got some bonus content for the VIP listeners who support the Torch.
Absolutely. Thank you, guys. We'll talk to y'all later.